Welcome to GBW Podcast. My name is Josh. With me, as always, is Chris.
Why, hello there, Mrs. Moneypenny.
Wow, in case you haven't guessed it, today we are doing James Bond, the Sean Connery, George Lazenby era.
62 to 71.
Plus one extra.
Plus one.
So
it's like the plus one is like when you feel obligated to take a relative you don't like to a party or a wedding. And you're like, ah, fuck, let's might as well take them. Jesus. It's kind of like this one's like the black sheep where it's technically not part of the Bond series, but we're just doing it. What the fuck, right?
That's right.
All right.
All right. So we're going to get right into James Bond. We're not going to have a lot of preamble this time.
Yeah, I'm just going to talk about one movie.
Yeah. So, Chris, why don't you go ahead and talk about that one
movie. So, because it would be, when we do our next episode in 2 weeks, it wouldn't be as relevant. I went to the theater.
The theater.
Yes, and I saw It.
Right.
2017, based on the Stephen King 1,000-plus page novel.
Yep.
And, half based on, I guess, based on the novel.
Right.
Since it only follows the child portion of the book. So, this movie is the movie that came out, was a juggernaut, made $123 million.
Yeah.
Opening weekend. Greatest marketing for a horror movie I've seen in a while, obviously, because it made that much money. A lot of people seem to be like, you know, creaming their shorts over this movie, as usual for when any horror movie comes out and is successful. People are like, oh my God, it's the best horror movie I've ever seen. Oh my God. So here's my take on it, being the cynical asshole that I tend to be.
Right.
And Josh, I guess we're both cynical assholes at times.
Well, you need to sell me on this one because I didn't really like the original. Well, I can't say I didn't like it, but the movie has never really resonated with me.
The original series, honestly, looks a little bit dated now.
Yeah. So like, even when I was a kid, like it never really connected with me, and I don't have any negative feelings towards it, but it's just sort of there.
Right. So this version is directed by Andy Muschietti, who has only made one other movie before this, and that was Mama.
Oh, okay.
The Guillermo del Toro produced kind of monstery movie from 2013. And the problem with this is that a lot of the complaints that people had about Mama, in the sense that he had hired a real contortionist actress to play the main creature in it, but then used CGI in the movie. That was a big complaint people had about Mama. He does the same thing in It.
No.
But I don't hear anybody complaining about it. So we've got Bill Skarsgård playing Pennywise.
Yeah.
Instead of Tim Curry this time. And granted, he's pretty good. Like, there's scenes when he's, you know, standing off to the side looking at the kids and he smiles and his cheeks go up and, you know, he's pretty good in that sense. But anytime Pennywise has to do anything remotely evil, it's CG.
Really?
Yeah. The CG is too heavily used for Pennywise.
I'm surprised.
So like anytime, like they'll be standing in a room, Pennywise will be off in the shadows talking to them, and then it'll rush the camera and rush the kids. It's CG.
Wow.
Because it does this skittery movement like,
right,
kind of like that, and it's CG. There's a really, really bad scene with Pennywise dancing in front of flames, all CG.
Oh,
like in the background and everything. Yeah. And you know, there's the basic story of it is about a bunch of kids in this town called Derry, where kids have been going missing. So there's a curfew, and it's about these kids kind of finding out that it's the doing of this evil clown who lives basically under the city in like the sewer and everything, and preys on the kids by bringing their worst fears to the forefront. So they form this group called the Losers Club, who kind of go against the parents to try and stop Pennywise having to deal with, you know, all these fucked up nightmare sequences that he unleashes on them. So, you know, each one has a different fear, and it's played pretty well.
Yeah.
Some of the fears are a little bit off because, like I said, CG reliance. So there's, you know, one scene with a guy who's like a real, like, kind of neat freak. He always wants to be clean. He's always worried about germs. He has this big, giant, hulking hobo character chase him, which is from his fears. But it's totally CG.
Wow.
Like
I am really surprised.
Like the faces just look really CG to me. It didn't feel practical, and that was a problem I had.
Yeah.
And also this movie is 2 hours and 15 minutes long.
Right.
Does not need to be 2 hours and 15 minutes
right.
long.
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard people saying that they feel like it didn't fit all of it into that running time, that it should have been longer. And meanwhile, I'm sitting here going, it should have been about, you know, an hour and 45 minutes.
Right.
Because I'm of the belief that really horror movies don't need to be more than an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah.
In general, I don't think any movie should really be over 2 hours, to be honest. I'm one of those people because there's too many fucking movies for me to watch in my lifetime to begin with. And yeah. Secondly, I feel like once a movie hits over 2 hours, with few exceptions, a lot of it is just extraneous padding that could be taken out.
Right.
And there's a little bit of that here. But I'm not going to rag on the movie because I'm going to say I did like it. I did find it entertaining. I found that the group of kids were great. They had good chemistry with each other. They played off each other really well. Finn Wolfhard from Stranger Things, local Vancouver boy.
Yeah.
He's really good in this because he's the comic relief. So he's going through the whole movie making jokes about having sex with the other guys' mothers and how big his dick is and everything. I'm like, that's totally me when I was that age. When I was like 12 or 13, I had that shit all the time.
Right.
We used to take songs and like make them dirty. Like that song Rock You the band Helix. You remember that song?
I don't think a lot of our listeners will remember that
look
song.
Look up the song Rock You by Helix on YouTube. There's a line in it where we change it to my dick's a pistol loaded like a gun. Okay. We used to do all that. And Rock You, we became Fuck You and all this stuff. And you know, like Quiet Riot, Come On Feel the Noise. It'd be Come On Feel the Noise, Girls Fuck Your Boys.
Don't they actually say that one time
in
the song?
No, they don't. They don't.
I think they do once.
Do they?
Yeah.
But anyway, so he's really good. All the other kids are really good. Skarsgård, when he's not a computer animation, is good.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the, there's a few pretty cool bloody moments in it. And, you know, the premise based on King's book, you can't really go wrong because it's kind of like Stand By Me meets Evil Clowns.
Right.
So, I mean, I liked it, but I didn't love it.
Okay.
That's what I'm going to say. I know a lot of people are really digging on this movie and thinking it's like the second coming of horror, but I seem to recall a couple of years ago The Witch was the second coming of horror, and last year I think it was Green Room was the second coming of horror, and 2012 Cabin in the Woods was the second coming of horror. So I'm just, you know, if something it feels like anytime something that's horror is really successful, people think it's like gonna save the fucking genre. And honestly, the genre doesn't need saving. It's a strong enough genre itself and has a lot of really good movies coming out every year that it doesn't need saving, and people shouldn't be like tying their boats up to this one movie and saying, this is it. This is the greatest thing.
Well, I think it's good for the genre, though, to have a big hit like this.
It is definitely good. I'm not
saying
saving,
it's actually like saving like the whole movie industry right now, which had a shitty summer and shitty Labor Day.
I mean, it's great. I'm happy it did what it did for money wise. But when it comes down to 2017 horror movies, Get Out is still my favorite.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's all I'm going to say about it. I'd say if you're into the book, if you like the miniseries, go check it out in theaters for sure. It's worth seeing in a theater. That's what I'm going to say.
Okay. I'm probably going to go see it next week.
The last thing is comparing Tim Curry to Skarsgård, you can't really do. They're entirely different beasts.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Well, that's it.
That's it. I did the thing where it's like, man, this is like an Abbott and Costello routine.
Yeah, totally.
I'm going to see it. See what? See it. What? It. What are you going to see?
All right. Well, let's get into Bond.
Okay, Mish Money Penny.
So
let's get it on.
Okay. So before we get started,
that's
here,
my bad Connery.
That was bad. Before we get started here.
Okay.
Okay. So this was mainly me pushing for us to go through the Bond series. So poor Chris hasn't seen very many of them.
I haven't seen any.
So he's got 25 movies to go through if you include Never Say Never Again. And if we include Bond 25, so it'll actually be 26 movies. We're hoping to get this done in the next year or so. You know, we're not going to do back-to-back Bond episodes because it's just too much. So we also decided to split it up again because it's just too much. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of stuff here. There's so much to talk about.
If it takes us 2.5 hours to talk about like four movies in a series, 25 fucking movies, it's going to be the longest podcast episode known to man.
Right. So we split it up. So it looks like we're probably going to do Connery and Lazenby. Then we'll do Moore.
Yep.
Then we'll do Dalton and Brosnan. And then we'll do Craig.
Craig. And then with the Craig one, we're going to kind of do a recap, kind of like what our favorites of all of the movies is.
Yeah, so it's going to be a while before you hear that.
Yeah, that's going to be a year out at least.
Yeah, for sure. Another thing I want to say is just Bond, and any Bond fan knows this, it's probably one of the most polarizing series out there. You rarely will read, I don't think I've ever seen like a top Bond list where it's in the same order.
Well, it's kind of like take it to the horror genre. It's like Friday the 13th. Nobody likes the same Friday the 13th for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, generally for like the best Bond, I find the same few kind of rotate. Mm-hmm. The worst Bond, Die Another Day, almost always those rotate as well.
Well, what are you saying? Are you saying that? After I'm getting over the giddiness of the Moore ones, which you've promised me are better than the Connery ones, I'm going to have to endure fucking Die Another Day.
It's only one movie, man. But boy, oh boy. It's something else.
Is that the one with the snowboarding?
Yeah.
I've seen that clip. So just quickly before we dive in. So the history of this is that Josh, big Bond fan, obviously. Yeah,
big Bond fan.
Watched him as a kid, and he said to me one day, he's like, dude, we should do Bond. And I was like, ah, fuck. I was like, okay, well, my experience with Bond in the past is just maybe catching a bits and pieces of it here and there when my dad used to watch it when I was a kid on TV. But I'm like, you know, I feel like kind of like how I feel when I say I haven't seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or The Godfather. I'm like, I kind of feel like I have to right a wrong here and at least watch some of these Bond movies so that I can at least be like, okay, I'm familiar with Bond apart from like all these parodies of gadgets and everything that I see everywhere. Yeah. I've at least seen some and I can actually kind of talk a little bit more intelligently on them. So that's kind of the impetus for me to do this. And, you know, I'm going to admit that this first batch for me was a little bit of a rough run.
Yeah.
And, but I've been assured that it's got nowhere to go but up from here. So I am kind of excited for these more ones, but let's talk about Connery. Let's do it.
Yeah. And just one other disclaimer is we have chosen to omit Casino Royale, the Peter Sellers parody, just because I don't think either of us really feel like it really fits in the true Bond canon.
I do have it at home because I did purchase it for cheap just in case, but then we decided I don't think it's going to work.
And although Never Say Never Again doesn't really either, it is Connery. So
it's not officially part of the series, but we will be talking about it this time.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so let's get to it.
All right.
We're going to go in chronological order.
Yep.
Starting with Dr. No from 1962. Directed by Terrence Young.
And my reaction when it was over was, Doctor, oh no.
Okay, and also I'm just going to kind of put things into perspective.
I'm trying not to be a negative Nancy. There's always going to be something in every movie that I'm going to have a positive on, just so people know.
Yeah. I do find it quite interesting, just the ages of Bond. So I am going to sort of list those as we're going through as well. So just to put into perspective, Connery was 31 when this was shot, so let's say 32 for the first ease is how old he was when Dr. No was made.
So before we talk about Dr. No, did you really write anything kind of about the origins of Bond? Like, do you have anything written down? Like, because it is based on Ian Fleming's books,
and of course,
a famous British author, and he did all these mysteries, and I think it was Cubby Broccoli. Is that the name of one of the producers?
And Salzman.
They picked up the property, and the reason there's so many Bond films is because these movies they were hits.
Yeah.
Just super hits. So just so if anyone's curious, if you want to see where the origin is, go to your library, look up Ian Fleming, and they're all there.
Yeah. And the production company that most of them were made under was called Eon Pictures.
Yeah.
And that was Cubby Broccoli's and Salzman's company. And that's where under, you know, so you might hear us referring to Eon a few times. We're just talking about the production company that did the majority of the Bond films. Okay, so Dr. No. Now, we're going to try and, I think the best way to sort of structure this, and we might, I'm not sure if we'll be able to do each one of them like this, is kind of go through the plot. Then we'll just sort of talk about our thoughts on the film. If we haven't already covered it, we'll talk about the villains, the girls,
yeah,
maybe the music a little bit, and some of the gadgets.
And there's going to be a lot of flipping noises from my side because I'm going to be referring to my notes quite a lot. So if you hear pages flipping, it's just me.
Yeah, and same here. Okay, so Dr. No. So we open up with... not with your typical James Bond opening. We open up with the Calypso version of Three Blind Mice.
Yep.
As there's these blind dudes going down the street. Oh, these episodes are going to be spoiler heavy if you haven't listened to any of our
yeah. It's probably best to say that they
series
are
series episodes. Yeah, we're going to be spoiling things. So if you're not a Bond fan or haven't seen these movies, you might want to check them out before you plow forward. Okay, so we've got the three blind men who are going to this Calypso song. You don't have the typical. I don't believe there was the tip. There wasn't the opening where he shoots at the camera. I don't believe in this one. There was because
In my notes I've already written down my first note for this movie was everyone knows the opening theme and the bloody shot. I'm like, Hell, even they spoofed this in Friday the 13th Part 6.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, ooh, silhouetted dancing girl. So I'm like, yes.
Yeah, but this wasn't like, it wasn't.
This
it,
isn't
it was
as
a little
over the
different
top
than
the
ones,
ones
we know. Yeah. One just quick note about the title sequence in this is that the man that's walking along and shoots at the camera is not Sean Connery.
Yeah.
In this one, it's actually stuntman Bob Simmons. And Connery actually didn't do this until, I believe, Thunderball. Okay. It was Bob Simmons for the first three using the same footage. Okay, so the three blind men end up killing an agent named Strangeways.
Yep.
Bond is sent in to investigate what happened into Jamaica. He soon, another character is introduced at the beginning as well, named Sylvia Trench. She's kind of like Bond's girlfriend, and she was actually going to be in a number of Bond movies. She actually returned in From Russia with Love, but her character was scrapped after that, which I think was a good choice. But she was pretty good looking and, nice to see Bond girl right off the bat.
You cannot give Bond a girlfriend.
Because
I'm going to be referring to what I wrote down in my notes a lot, just because I wrote down here, suave motherfucker winning cards and lighting a smoke from a silver holder.
Yes, he is.
So that, you know, I'm like, you don't think of Bond being like, I'm going to settle down and have two kids and a dog.
Yeah.
It's more like, no, I'm going to fuck as many women as I can while I'm beating up Spectre and stuff.
Exactly. But, The way Bond's introduced is actually really cool too, because they don't show him right away. It's kind of really like leading up to him. But we do meet Sylvia Trench, played by Eunice Gayson. She is technically the first Bond girl we ever see, so it is pretty historic in that manner. Bond also is, there's another woman that shows up, a photographer at the airport in Kingston, Jamaica. She doesn't really pan out that much, and then he gets into a car and ends up getting into his first kind of action sequence as he gets into a fight with the chauffeur.
Yeah, I just like how like he shows up in Jamaica, and automatically people are following him, and automatically he's being looked at suspiciously, and the drivers are like kind of chomping at the bit to go after him. I'm like, it's like, okay, we know he's a suave guy, but shit, give him a chance to at least land in the country before you're going after him.
Totally. But they did a good job, right? Okay, so next we meet up with Bond gets into another fight with a character named Quirrell. And Quirrell is like, and we see again, we're seeing a lot of things in Dr. No that we're going to see over and over again throughout the series. So, I mean, we've got the Bond girl established. Quirrell. He's like a side character that's like an ally of Bond that's probably doomed. This happens repeatedly throughout the series. Another thing I just wanted to note in this is director Terrence Young is really the guy who helped establish the way that Bond is. He has really helped establish the character. He really coached Connery in how to be a suave motherfucker. And yeah, Terrence Young is kind of the guy who is really known as really making the character what it is, not Connery. He really coached Connery, and he was kind of like this himself, I believe. Another thing I just wanted to point out with Dr. No, and especially in these early scenes, is the first fight scene. You really, I really noticed the editing. It's got a lot of, like, you know, really kind of choppy, fast editing. Like, they undercrank the camera, so, like, fights seem a little sped up at times. That's directly related to editor Peter Hunt, who would go on to direct some of the titles that we'll hear about. Well, one of the titles that we'll hear about later on. Okay, so Bond gets into this fight with this character named Quirrell, who ends up being his ally. Another character shows up named Felix Leiter, who ends up breaking up the fight. Felix Leiter is a character that's going to show up, played by many different actors in a number of the films as well. In this particular film, he's played by Jack Lord, who is, of course, the star of Hawaii Five-0. And I thought he was really cool. And Jack Lord actually was going to come back for other Bond movies, but he didn't, because A, he wanted more money, B, he wanted more screen time, and C, it was almost like he was more cool than Bond. So they didn't want him to be showing up Bond. But I really like Jack Lord as Felix Leiter. We then meet a character named RJ Dent, who's kind of a henchman type. And another kind of major scene from the Bond series is when he tries to kill Bond with a tarantula.
Right.
Which I thought that was a pretty cool scene. What did you think of the tarantula scene?
I'm having, because I watched this a while ago, I'm just trying to, like, piece together from my notes the plot. And anything with a tarantula is kind of cool anyway, regardless, right? Like, it's different to see them trying to kill the hero with something other than a gun.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of this in this movie. Like, there's them setting up traps for him. Like, there's a scene early on where he's like, you know, we hadn't seen any gadgets yet, but I remember Bond, he, like, sets up his hair.
Oh yeah,
so that he can see if they've broken into the closet of his
hotel
room.
Yeah, he rips out a piece of hair and, like, puts it across the crack. Yeah, so he's doing
stuff like that, and, you know, and there's also just your typical, like, car chases and fist fights. So to see them actually using, like, a tarantula to try and kill him is it's fun.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a fun idea and kind of fits into what I was kind of expecting from these movies, which I honestly felt like Dr. No was a little bit light on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The tarantula scene was kind of cool because, I mean, it's pretty clear that there's glass between Sean Connery and the tarantula. But there are scenes where the tarantula is actually crawling on him, but it's actually not him. He refused to do it, so it's against it. And Bob Simmons did that. So we have the tarantula. Then Bond ends up killing RJ Dent. And then he ends up going to he hooks up with Quirrell again, and they end up going to a place called Crab Key, where they suspect that there's something's going on. So they go to this island called Crab Key, and
all the locals are scared and suspicious.
Yeah, yeah. Theme we'll revisit in Live and Let Die. But as Bond is there, he is hanging out on the beach and hears someone singing. And there we get a very, very iconic shot from the Bond series with Ursula Andress coming out of the water as Honey Rider singing under the mango tree. And this is, again, like, a lot of really iconic things were happening in this movie, despite what you think of it. It did really set the tone in a lot of everyone, ways.
Even me, not having really seen this series, know that scene.
Yeah.
Where she's coming out of the water. I mean, how could you not?
Exactly. It's something else.
She's coming out of the water in this, like, super hot bikini with a knife strapped to her. I mean, come on.
Yeah, she's quite the babe, that's for sure.
I just wanted to throw out there that before that scene happens, though, there was this car chase that I thought was pretty damn funny. because it was like they were doing all their crazy faces and their overactive steering. And then during the chase, it ends with this fiery cliff drop where the car drops off the cliff and explodes. And someone asked Bond what happened. He goes, I think they were on their way to a funeral. And I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of quips actually in all these movies that I kind of had fun with. And yeah. That was the first one that I wrote it down because I was like, oh, that's pretty cool.
It's pretty badass. Okay, so what happens now? So
the flamethrower vehicle.
What?
There's a flamethrower vehicle.
The, there's a thing called the Dragon, which is a...
Yeah.
Yeah, this like everyone's... And I think this is what all the locals were scared of. There's this like sort of tractor that's driving around on the beach with a big flamethrower that comes out. And
I put like 4 fucking exclamation points beside flamethrower vehicle. I was so excited.
It's pretty rad. And it's kind of like going after them on the beach, and poor old Quarrel meets his end, and Bond and Honey Rider end up getting captured by the henchmen that are like driving the flamethrower. They end up being brought back to a decontamination shower in Dr. No's lair, and I thought that scene was pretty risque. I always sort of remembered them as being naked as that was happening, but and I think they were supposed to be, but you could clearly see that Ursula Andress was wearing like a skin colored bikini.
And I think that scene was also ripped off in one of the Austin Power movies too.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. Because
there's a lot of stuff obviously in these that was ripped off in that.
Yeah, there really was.
But I just wanted to quickly throw out there that when they get back to Dr. No's lair, I really thought the production design was pretty funky. All that like garish colors and everything, and then I also wanted to point out that I wrote down here that so Dr. No is a Chinese baddie played by a white Canadian.
That's true.
So I was like, okay, there's our first instance of racial stereotyping in the Bond series, and there's much more to come.
That's for sure. And just a word on the production design. That was by Ken Adam. I've talked about Ken Adam on the show before. He's probably my favorite production designer. He's the only production designer I think of, like when I hear the name production designer, like he's the only one I really know by name. And I love all of his work. He's worked with Kubrick, and he's worked on all kinds of really cool, Salon Kitty, of course. And he worked on a whole bunch of Bond films. So we're going to be hearing his name quite a bit too. But that whole, big underground layer thing, that's all Ken Adam.
That layer's pretty cool.
And he also designed a lot of the gadgets as well. But he was awesome and really had a real style about him. And I find a lot of stuff to do. Stuff with Ken Adam was a lot of really big sets. And I also noticed a lot of like small like pieces of furniture in a giant set. And
right.
Just a really, really, you really noticed when Ken Adam was a production designer. Okay, so after they're decontaminated, we get to meet Dr. No, as Chris said.
We find out he has fake hands.
Yeah. And we also, again, another kind of thing that's been spoofed many times in Austin Powers and other movies, where the Bond villain who then just goes on to explain his entire plot and his entire plan to Bond,
of course,
because he thinks he's going to kill Bond, and then of course Bond then gets all the information and turns the tables.
Because that's basically just a chance for Bond to formulate his plan of getting out of this situation, because he has to listen to the bad guy blather on for 15 minutes about how he's going to take over the world, right?
He does, and it happens in every movie.
Meanwhile, while he's doing that, Bond's sitting on the table, one side of his brain is like, which lady am I gonna fuck? And on the other side, he was like, how am I gonna overthrow this guy and rip his face off?
Exactly.
You know? It's like Bond has the two sides of the brains. One of the sides is his horny side. The other side's like, hey, he's explaining this whole thing to me. I'm totally gonna beat him up in about 5 minutes.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so we find out Dr. No works for Spectre. Yeah. So we'll just get this out of the way. Yep. Spectre stands for Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, and Extortion. In case you've ever been
rolls
wondering.
Off the tongue.
Okay, and Dr. No's plan is he wants to disrupt... It's a stupid plan.
All of them generally are.
This is a really stupid plan.
No, but generally in all of them, it's pretty stupid plan.
Like, this is no Dr. Evil. He's not trying to get money or anything.
He doesn't want a shark with freaking lasers on their heads.
He's just trying to disrupt the space launch with an atomic beam. So... whatever. There's also... Okay,
but why is he wanting to do it? I don't remember.
It doesn't really say, because he's
just like, I'm just going to fuck with the Americans.
Terrorism?
Like, I guess terrorism. He's just stopping a launch.
I don't know. Like, that's what I... Is that what you got out of it? Like,
yeah, I think
that's so. What I think his plan was. Some of these movies are a little confusing. We'll get to more confusing ones shortly.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did find the plots a little hard to follow, but that was what I got out of it. That's what he was trying to do.
Sounds about right.
Okay, so Bond gets, you know, sort of gets away. He then has to go through this air duct that's like got some obstacles in it. Can't remember what they were, but I know it had some like
all
booby traps
air ducts
in it.
Have obstacles in
it. Didn't it have like knives coming out or something? I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know.
Then
by this point, I had honestly kind of my brain had checked out a little bit by this point,
right?
Because I was like sitting there going, "All right, so here we are. We're 45 minutes into this movie. It's taken a little bit of a time to get rolling, and then a little bit later, I'm like, okay. So now we're like an hour in, and this movie's, you know, it's been pretty good at establishing these characters and having these distinctive features of them. But you know, there's not really a lot going on here, and you know, Dr. No is not. The movie's called fucking Dr. No, and I really don't know who Dr. No is for the most part. It's,
yeah, totally.
You know? And I think that's a problem with a lot of these Connery ones is that they hype up their villain, and then the villain just doesn't show up forever.
They do that, and I also find the plots get so convoluted, like, having trouble.
Yeah, there's a couple that we're going to talk about where I was just like, what the fuck is going on right now?
Yeah. They simplify a lot more when we get to the Moore era.
Well, that's good. Then maybe you're right. Maybe I will like them more.
Yeah. So, you know, the only other things I'm going to note about this is, again, like Chris mentioned, the production design is pretty cool. There's, like, a control center with, like, a nuclear reactor in the middle.
And... keep going. I got to add something when you're
and
done.
And then, you know, there's a big fight. Dr. No gets thrown in a bunch
That's
of
it,
boiling
dude.
Water.
He gets fucking jokered.
He does get
jokered. He gets jokered in a fucking radioactive pool.
He does.
And that was awesome. I'm just like, oh, yeah, he's getting jokered right now. This is the best. I'm like, I waited about fucking, what, almost 2 hours for this. I'm like... thank God that Connery in this movie is so suave that I was just like, okay, fine, Sean, go ahead, do your thing. And then I'm like, he got jokered. Okay, I can forgive some of this movie now.
Yeah. Okay, so that's pretty much the plot, but
yeah,
we're just going to get right into like what we think about it. And yeah, I totally agree with Chris. Like, the main problem with Dr. No is the movie's called fucking Dr. No.
Yeah.
And you're waiting for like ever to get to Dr. No. And he's kind of cool. He is pretty memorable. Like, when I think of Bond villains, his face does pop up in my brain. But, you know, he's got this cool, like, removable hand or whatever. But it's, like, the lamest fight. Like, it's, like, a few punches and he's chasing him and he falls in the water and that's the end.
It was pretty mild fisticuffs for a finale of a movie.
Yeah, like, he just seems so underwhelming, like, when the whole movie's named after him, right? Like, I was expecting much more.
He should be like King Kong, motherfucker. They named a movie after King Kong and look what he did.
Exactly.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, so Dr. No, played by Joseph Wiseman, just didn't really...
A white Canadian playing a Chinaman, by the way.
Yeah, Chinaman?
A Chinese person. Yeah. I would just like to say that again because I blew my fucking mind.
Yeah, yeah. And not a lot... Joseph Wiseman, there was not a lot of other roles that I really noticed as being too important for him. Ursula Andress, of course, was one of the biggest sex symbols of the era, of the 60s. Her voice was done. She was overdubbed by a woman named Nikki Vanderzil, who actually overdubbed some other women later in the series. We were introduced to Moneypenny in this movie.
And I got to tell you.
And M.
I got to tell you, Moneypenny was probably my favorite thing out of all these Connery movies.
I know you mentioned that before. So what's your deal with Moneypenny?
She's just really charming. Because she just puts up with his lady killer attitudes and just flirts with him. And you know, he never takes her seriously. And they just seem to be more like playful siblings than anything.
Right.
I really like that dynamic because a lot of these movies, that's just so damn serious all the time. And to have her just joking with him and flirting with him, I just really appreciated that. It kind of added some levity to what was going on. Because like you said, a lot of these movies, the plots were just so... convoluted and I wasn't sure what was going on a lot of times. So when Moneypenny would show up, I'd be like, oh, there we go. There's something I can relate to and have fun with.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I liked her the most in these, because these Connery ones, I did find a lot of the plots to be very fucking confusing.
Yeah. No, it's always great. Moneypenny, I think she showed up in almost all the movies, as well as her as their boss, M, played by Bernard Lee. Moneypenny was played by Lois Maxwell. And, yeah, I mean, they're kind of like the familiarity that you're going to encounter through all the movies. And I always look forward to both of their scenes because I found M was kind of the same way. He kind of, you know, he's Bond's boss, but he kind of knows what he's like and kind of puts up with him, right?
Well, and then same thing with Q, who's not in this movie. He's in the next one.
Yeah.
He's another guy who you would be like, when you're watching these movies, I'm like, okay, where's Q now? Where is he going to show off these cool things he's invented? You know, I'm like, fuck Freckles and Batman Begins. Q's the original. Q's the OG. I want to see him come and show me these gadgets he's done, because I'm like, this is what I signed up for. I signed up for fucking gadgets.
Who's and Freckles in Batman Begins?
Morgan Freeman.
Oh,
you know I call him Freckles. But I'm just
he's
like,
not like Q. You think Alfred's like Q?
He's not Alfred.
Isn't he?
No. He's Lucius Fox. He's the guy who, like, created, like, the big bat tank and everything.
I haven't seen those in so long.
Yeah. No. He's not the butler.
Who's the butler? Michael
Are you
Caine.
Assuming he's the butler because he's black?
Michael Caine, right? It's the butler. Yeah, okay. Anyway.
Like I said, Moneypenny for me was just, like, all these characters, these side characters, they're just people who kind of show up and I'm like, okay, this is something I can relate to. This is, like you said, this is people I can relate to. This is taking me kind of back to the, out of this plot where I'm kind of like, I'm not 100% sure what's going on right now.
Yeah.
And that's like a welcome, you know.
Welcome back.
A welcome step back from convolution, to be honest.
Yeah. No, I agree. I only wish they maybe showed up a little more sometimes. But
yeah.
Okay, and yeah, on the subject of Q, Peter Burton played Q in this round, but afterwards it was always Desmond Llewellyn.
Q's not even in this movie.
There's a character played by Peter Burton called Quartermaster, I believe, technically Q.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but it's not the Q we know and love.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess the only really other thing I wanted to mention about the cast was there was another Bond girl played by Zena Marshall called Miss Taro. She was, I think, I can't really remember her that much, but I know she was in it. He beds her at some point.
He bedded everybody at some point except for Moneypenny. He generally did. I have a line written down in my notes that just says, dude gets all the women. Because he does.
He really does. Yeah.
He just basically could walk into a room and they throw their panties at him.
They pretty much do. He's like Tom Jones.
Only much more attractive than Tom Jones.
Yes. Okay. Just some other notes on this one. Ken Adam, again, production designer. He worked on 7 Bond films in total. This was the first one. The character of Dent, one of the guys that Bond ends up killing, he was played by an actor named Anthony Dawson, who would actually return in From Russia with Love and Thunderball, but he wasn't playing Dent anymore. He was playing Blofeld, and we never saw his face, so that's why you don't know that it's the same actor, but it is the same actor. And I think that's pretty much it for Dr. No.
Yep.
So I know I feel the same way as Chris. Like I was, you know, and I'm familiar with this movie, and I was a little like, oh, that did not hold up to my memories of this movie. And I've seen it a few times throughout my life, but this time in particular, maybe it's because I was just thinking that you were watching it, and I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, I think it almost might have affected my enjoyment of the movie, thinking of you watching it and going, oh, fuck, oh, no, we're off to a bad start, you know, because it is pretty slow.
Yeah.
But it does set the tone for so many things that are to come.
It's like I said, even though I wasn't a huge fan of Dr. No, and I was just kind of like, okay, well, what I can take from this movie is that I liked these certain things, and I hope they tighten up on these certain things. I'm like, I hope they at least get stuff moving faster in the sequels.
Right.
You know, and that's really, like, I didn't dislike Dr. No, but I was just like, if this is how it begins, I mean, even I was like, I hadn't seen the Bond movies, but I was familiar with the tropes of Bond.
Right.
And even I was like, this really doesn't have a lot of the stuff that I was kind of thinking Bond was. And that, because a lot of that didn't start until our next subject.
Exactly. So just wrapping up Dr. No. So we've talked about the girls, mainly Honey Rider. We've talked about the villain, pretty much Dr. No. We've talked about the music. There isn't really a theme song or anything. We've got a bit of the title sequence, but not really what we're used to. Gadgets. There's not a lot of gadgets in this. There's a Geiger counter shows up when they're on Crab Key. There's also a... This is the first
film.
But is
a Geiger counter really a gadget? My definition,
it's not,
definition of gadgets in Bond movies are stuff that, you know, serves a different purpose than what it looks like. Like okay. A pen that shoots a laser.
So we're just going to stick to cool gadgets. I'm not going to go over everything.
Okay.
The one thing I do want to point out as far as, and this isn't really a gadget, but it is a piece of equipment. This is the movie where he's introduced to his gun that he uses in pretty much every other movie, the Walch PPK. Okay. He has another type of gun, and I believe it's Q, the character of Q in this movie, a quartermaster, that does give him that new gun, and that's the gun he uses throughout the series.
Okay.
So that's about it. Okay, so moving on. We're done with Dr. No. So, I feel like I'm talking a lot. Okay, so next in the series is From Russia with Love. Now this is a movie, actually, this may have been my first time watch for this one.
Really?
Yeah. So it's from 1963. Terrence Young returned to direct. Connery was 33 now in this one. So the plot on this one is a little hard to follow. Okay. First of all, let's talk about, this one has an opening a pre-credit sequence.
Yeah.
So we didn't have that in Dr.
Yeah, after Dr. No, all of them had a pre-credit sequence. Yeah.
So this one has a pre-credit sequence that I thought was pretty cool.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah. So this has Bond being kind of like chased around this estate, from what I remember.
Yeah.
And he ends up getting captured or killed by a character named Donald Red Grant. And it's kind of like an obstacle course, and then Red Grant captures his character and strangles him with a wire that I think comes out of his watch or something. And we're led to believe that it's Bond that's being killed. But no, it's actually a double, and we find out that it's actually a Spectre training ground for assassins.
Yeah.
And this is like a test that they're doing.
Bait and switch.
Yeah, but it was a pretty fun pre-title sequence.
I liked the opening. I was like, okay, well, so far off to a pretty good start.
Yeah. We then learn that...
And I got to admit, because this was the first time they went full bore on the credits, too.
Yeah.
That I really love the credits in this one, because they're all neon colored, and it's got the belly dancing girls, and I was like, oh yeah, this is the Bond kind of credits I want. So
it's true, but the interesting thing was is that the guy who we kind of know for doing the credits is named Maurice Binder, and he actually did Dr. No, but he didn't do this one.
Really?
He left the series for two episodes, and this was actually done by a guy named Robert Brown John. I really liked it too, and it did really set the tone for something that Maurice Binder would do later on and become quite famous for. Okay, so we quickly learn that Spectre, kind of the main plot that's going on at the beginning here, Spectre wants revenge on Bond because we find out that Dr. No was an agent of Spectre. Well, we actually learned that before, but that's what's going on here. That's why this character's, you know, going after the Bond character. We learn that Blofeld is his AKA is number one. We also learn that that there's another agent named Rosa Klebb that works for Spectre. She's known as number three. So the reason I'm mentioning the numbers is just because if you're an Austin Powers fan, you know that that's a huge thing in the Austin Powers universe, is they really rip off the whole number one, number two, number three thing. So that was really quite noticeable to me. We also meet a character named Tatiana Romanova. And she was played by Daniela Bianchi. And quite the babe.
Mm-hmm.
I thought really gave Ursula Andress a run for her money. I actually liked her better. And I actually thought she was a little more of a Bond girl in that she had a little more going on than Ursula Andress did.
Well, yeah, she was more independent, I guess, in a way.
Yeah.
Which was what's good because, like, you know, Ursula was really just eye candy in the first movie, to be honest.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Now, Romanova's character believes that Rosa Klebb, a.k.a. number three, is a Soviet. And she, again, a little convoluted here, but she was basically trying to. She was pretending that she was going to defect to the other side, and she asked to have Bond handle her as she was defecting.
Oh, I bet she asked that was her cover. To handle her.
Now she doesn't realize that she's secretly working for Spectre because she thinks that Rosa Klebb, who works for Spectre, is a Russian. So. Yeah, I thought that was a little confusing, but we, you know, what you need to know here really is that you've got Spectre, who are the bad guys. We kind of know that by now. And then we've got this woman kind of caught in the middle. We meet Q again. He gives Bond an attaché case, which is kind of one of the first real gadgets in the Bond series.
Can we just roll back for 1 second?
Yeah.
Because I'm looking at my notes. There's a scene early in the movie where they're in Venice and they're at a chess tournament.
I didn't like that
and
scene.
I'm just like, holy fuck, look at the crowds for that chess tournament. Like, they're going crazy.
I know.
Like, I'm like, how does that happen? That's like all that when I see crowds at golf games on TV. I'm like, what the fuck are these people doing there watching this?
Yeah.
So boring.
It really was. But I guess they were like grandmasters. They were like the Bobby Fischer. It was a Bobby Fischer type character or something.
And I also wanted to point out that before Q shows up, there's an awesome scene in a training area where there's guns, flamethrowers, and karate, and Robert Shaw shows up as Grant, the psycho hitman.
Well, he's in the opening scene, too.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. He's so fucking cool.
He really is. I mean, Robert Shaw plays Red Grant, and he's definitely one of the better of the big heavies in a Bond film.
He's pretty cool. I just want to mention that training area was pretty sweet.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was a bad guy, I'd want to go train there. You like friggin' strap on a flamethrower. Next minute, you're like friggin' karate chopping the shit out of someone. It's pretty awesome.
The bad guys always had like the wicked shit in the bottom.
I know. They always had the wicked training centers, didn't they? It's like this thing's carried over to 80s martial arts movies too. Because like all the canon ninja movies, they always had like these big compounds where they'd be like chopping the heads off of dummies with swords and throwing ninja stars. And,
yeah,
I think. Maybe
Enter the Dragon was really influential on that too. I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's
awesome.
For sure. Okay, so Bond meets up with Q, gets his attaché case. Then he meets up with another ally named Ali Kirimbe.
By the way, he did the fingers for ally. You know,
well, he is an ally, but he's also doomed.
Doomed, like all of them?
Yeah. Ali Kirimbe. I really like this character quite a bit. And he's kind of leading Bond around and as they're trying to figure out what's going on. They go under the city. They like have this periscope, which is kind of a cool gadget where they like are spying on I believe, Romanova, from what I remember. Then they decide to get out of town and they head to a
gypsy camp.
A very stereotypical
gypsy camp. This is the kind of gypsy camp Stephen King would write about in Thinner.
Exactly.
But I gotta admit, I kind of like this scene.
I do like the scene, but you're right. It's like the Thinner gypsy's camp or like the Lon Chaney werewolf gypsy camp. Like it's the very typical gypsy camp.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it's got your typical, like, they've got their caravans. And
yeah.
They've got their fires and they've got their belly dancers and all that.
And they're their
stuff.
Leader guy who's like really Middle Eastern and kind of a racist caricature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And par for the course for these films.
What's that?
Par for the course for these films, really.
Yeah, really. Okay, so they head to the gypsy camp. Okay, so a few things happen at the gypsy camp.
There's some sweet things that happen at the gypsy camp.
Okay, my favorite thing that happens at the gypsy camp is a cat fight between two gypsies.
I just wrote that. I have that written down here. I'm like, cat fight equals great.
Yeah, one of whom is played by Eliza Gur, who's like in real life was like an Israeli, like a combat trained like soldier. And the other one is played by Martine Beswick, who's like one of my favorite Hammer girls. And she's also in Thunderball, but she is like scantily clad fighting with this other woman in the middle of the gypsy camp with the fire blazing behind. It's pretty awesome. And I think they're fighting over Bond, aren't they?
I think so. Yeah, they're all like, who gets to have sex with Bond? No, me. They should have just done what gypsies always do and thrown knives to decide.
Yeah.
If you want to fit with stereotypes, you might as well do it.
Yeah. And then the other thing that happens at the gypsy camp is there's kind of a siege on the gypsy camp and a big kind of fight breaks out. And,
yeah. And what I got to say is that by this point, I thought compared to Dr. No, I found the pacing to be a lot better.
I agree.
Up to this point.
Yeah.
And I also found that this also started a trend more so than Dr. No, where the Bond movies just like to kind of jump back and forth to all these exotic locales.
Yeah.
Because they did that. I didn't really notice them doing that in Dr. No. And after this film.
Well, they were in Jamaica in Dr. No.
I know, but it's not so much. In this, I found that in all the ones after from Russia with Love on, they went to at least three or four different locations throughout the world to kind of display these different locales, and I was like, okay, the pacing's good. I've already been to, like, I'm at a gypsy camp, there's chicks beating the crap out of each other. I'm like, okay, let's keep this positive note rolling right now.
I agree. Yeah. Okay, so they get through the siege of the gypsy camp, and somehow I believe Bond, Ali Karim Bey, and Romanova go onto a train. And
I would just like to say that right after I said that the gypsy camp was like, I'm really into it, I filmed the midsection of this movie before we get to the Oriental Express thing you're about to talk about, really slowed down.
Where they were going. Okay. I kind of agree. I did find it slowed down, but I really liked that character, like the buddy he was with, this Karim Bey guy. I really liked him, he was funny and kind of charming, and he was kind of like Sala in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, he was that type of character. And I did enjoy that character quite a bit. So maybe that's why it didn't wear on me as much as you, but
maybe.
But I do agree it did slow down quite a bit.
Yeah.
But until it picked up again at the gypsy camp. So they go from the gypsy camp onto the Orient Express. And, there's a death on the train, and then, Bond ends up getting into a fight with...
Well, you have Bond and Tatiana having to pose as newlyweds.
Right.
To get on the train in the first place. And then, obviously, Shaw's character shows up.
Yeah.
And they have this pretty elaborate brawl.
Pretty brutal brawl.
While the train's moving. And that's a pretty cool scene, too.
It's probably the best fist fight scene in all of the Bond movies.
I think it's one of the better ones in the fact that I found a lot of the fist fight scenes in these movies to look a little bit too staged.
Yeah.
Whereas I didn't really find that with this one particularly. Like, yeah. I found it to be feel more realistic in a way.
Yeah. And I think that's because the actors were doing a lot of the stunts themselves, and they took forever to shoot this as well. I think it took something like 3 weeks to film the fist fight or something crazy like that.
I just really liked Robert Shaw in this movie though.
He was great, man.
Like, I just like how he had no dialogue, pretty much.
Yeah.
And he's just constantly lurking in the background until he has to pose as a fellow British agent.
Yeah.
And he's just like, I just think he's like, up to this point, I'm like, okay, this guy's cool. And I'm like, I almost like him better than Bond.
Okay, so Robert Shaw, in case you're unaware, if you've seen Jaws, Robert Shaw is Quint in Jaws. And you would never know that Quint from Jaws is playing this hulking monster muscle hitman dude.
I was quite surprised, too, when he first showed up, because I was like, oh, shit, it's Robert Shaw.
He looks good in this. He's built. He's strong. He's blonde. He doesn't have a fucking mustache. And he, he's pretty awesome in this, but it's like a completely different actor than Quint. But he really, really stands out as one of the best Bond henchmen for sure. After the fight on the train, we then kind of think that the movie's over because it kind of seems like everything's kind of wrapped up. But then there's a big powerboat chase. I kind of felt like the powerboat chase was a little anticlimactic. And then that's it.
Yeah, and there's also, wasn't there a helicopter involved in that?
There was a helicopter before the powerboat chase.
Yeah, there's like this helicopter set piece, too, that they just threw in there because they're like, hey, we've got a helicopter.
Yeah, we've got a helicopter. Helicopters were pretty new at the time, so I'm sure it was quite a big deal.
Like,
then.
We got a helicopter, let's do this thing.
Yeah,
I found the same thing, kind of like you said with Dr. No. I thought the finale could have been stronger because, like, all the stuff leading up to the gypsy camp, I'm like, okay, I'm down with this so far. This is pretty good. And then, like I said, there was that section in the middle that dragged me out of it. And then the Orient Express thing, I wasn't as enamored of it as like the assault on the camp. But I was like, okay, Robert Shaw's kicking some ass. This is pretty good. And then the finale just felt like, you know, we're just going to throw everything we have at the screen. And we managed to get a helicopter, so might as well throw that shit in there too. And it just didn't work for me, particularly the finale of this one either.
Yeah, I agree. So. I agree. Now, overall, though, I did think it was quite a step up from Dr. No.
I enjoyed it more than Dr. No.
And kind of felt a little bit more like this kind of spy film.
It was kind of heading towards what I, going in, my preconceived notions of a Bond film should be.
Yeah.
This is more in line with what I was expecting than what Dr. No gave me. So,
yeah, and this is also like a, you know, when we're talking about like favorites, like, you know, I mentioned at the beginning, like there's usually a few revolving as like the best Bond film. From Russia with Love generally comes up on those type of lists as like the best Bond film. It's really way up there as far as like what people perceive as the best Bond film. I don't know if I'm necessarily in that camp.
I'm not really. We're gonna kind of rank these at the end anyway. So
yeah, it's not the worst, but nope. I don't know if I'd go for.
I definitely thought it was a step up from Dr. No, though.
Yeah. The other thing too is, you know, you got to remember, like with a lot of Bond fans, you really do. I find there's a Connery camp.
Yeah.
There's a Moore camp, and it seems to me I think there was a bit of a Brosnan camp, and then there's a Craig camp.
Why would there be a Brosnan camp?
I'm definitely...
I don't like Brosnan on a good day when he's not playing Bond.
Well, I could see why people liked him. I definitely can see why people liked him. But it just seems like the people that got into Bond at the beginning are from the Connery camp, and they don't understand why anyone would like Roger Moore or any of the other guys.
Whereas you came in the Moore.
I'm from the Moore area because those are the first ones I saw, right?
Right.
So, okay, so let's just talk about some of the actors. Ali Karim Bey was played by an actor named Pedro Armendariz, Mexican actor. Now, he had a bit of a tragic story in that during the filming of From Russia with Love, he discovered that he actually had inoperable cancer. And he got very, very sick throughout the production of this film and ended up... being unable to finish, so that character was actually doubled for some of the scenes, and he actually went and killed himself in real life before the movie was wrapped because he was in so much agony. So that's pretty tragic, especially from such a likable character.
But, yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah, sorry, man.
I'm fucking bummed out.
Robert Shaw, of course, is Donald Red Grant,
and awesome.
Yeah. Now, some of the other actors that more from the Bond girl type of area, Eunice Gayson returns as Sylvia Trench. This is the last time we've ever seen her. She had a very small role in this one. Rosa Klebb was played by an actress named Lott Lenya. She was an Austrian or German, I think, singer. Her main claim to fame, other than being Rosa Klebb in this movie, is that she was mentioned in the very famous song "Mack the Knife." We also I've talked about Elisa Gura and Martine Beswick. There's also an actress named Nadia Regia. She played Kareem's mistress. She was just kind of around when in his lair and stuff. And she ended up coming back at the beginning of Goldfinger as a different character. This was also notable for not having Ken Adam doing production design, nor did it have Maurice Binder, as I mentioned earlier, doing the titles, nor did it have Bob Simmons doing the stunts. So some major losses from Dr. No, but maybe not such a bad thing. I mean, I think I did notice the production design was not as elaborate. But the fight sequences I still thought were pretty good, despite Bob Simmons not being around. The theme song is called From Russia with Love, played by Matt Monro, or sung by Matt Monro. It again is not played over the opening credits, but we do hear it during the movie, and we also hear it over the end credits.
Right.
Which is also a little different, because from Goldfinger onwards, for the most part, there was a pretty famous theme song in all of them. John Barry did the theme, From Russia with Love song. He also did the main Bond theme. And there's also another theme that came up in this movie. Its official title is called 007 Takes a Lecter, but it's kind of that percussive dun 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 dun. It comes up in like every Bond movie following this. So we've got the, you know, dun 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 dun. We've got that Bond theme that we all know. There's also the secondary Bond theme that you'll definitely recognize, especially on the DVD menus. It just plays on and on and on. But that was also first seen in From Russia with Love. This is also the first film at the end credits to have the James Bond will return in credit. And that played through, I think, every movie until like Octopussy or something. So every movie at the end, you'd know what the next Bond movie was going to be. And just one more note on the crew. One of the assistant directors is named Kit Lambert. He ended up becoming the manager for The Who and is featured in that movie. It was a documentary a few years ago called Lambert and Stamp. Yep. That's the Lambert.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
the only thing I want to add is about Daniela Bianchi.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, I when I was looking into her, I found it pretty funny that in 1969, she co-starred with Neil Connery, Sean Connery's brother, in an Italian-made ripoff of Bond called OK Connery.
Oh, yeah.
Also known as Operation Kid Brother.
Operation Kid Brother.
And I think I need to try and hunt that movie
down. So who did she co-star with?
Neil Connery.
No, and who else?
I don't remember who else is in it.
I think M and Moneypenny are both in it.
Oh, are they? Okay.
Much to the chagrin of Sean Connery. I don't think he was very happy about that.
Okay, I didn't know that. I just thought it was funny that she was with his brother in a Bond ripoff.
Yeah, no doubt.
An Italian Bond ripoff on top of that.
So yeah,
a pretty funny little fact I learned.
I remember you posted a poster for that, I think, on one of our social media
areas. Yeah, and I was like, look at this thing. I gotta see this.
I definitely want to see that as well. I didn't even know Sean Connery had a younger brother. And
well, I guess that's probably his only movie.
Yeah, maybe. I know his son, he had a son that ended up being in some stuff too.
Jason Connery, isn't it?
Yeah, he was in that terrible Ghost House Underground movie, Brotherhood of Blood.
Ooh.
Yeah,
stepping up.
I have some other note about Bianchi, but I can't freaking read my own writing. So
good job.
I know I need glasses or something. So let's just get to the gadgets just for a second. One cool one that was a non Bond gadget but was pretty cool was Rosa Klebb's like knife shoe. That she had these shoes and then this like stiletto would come out of them and she'd like stab people with it, which I thought was pretty neat. There wasn't a lot else going on here. There was a his attaché case had like a tear gas cartridge in it, but I don't remember if that was actually used. Do you remember?
I don't think so, unless somebody tried to break into the suitcase and got a face full of it.
Yeah. And he also has had a throwing knife, and which he used with against Robert Shaw, and he had a sniper rifle. But again, nothing too fancy. I thought Rosa Klebb's stiletto shoes were like the coolest gadget in this one. But yeah, I mean, overall, From Russia with Love,
step in the right direction,
yeah. But. You know, maybe not quite there yet.
Not
Connery
yet.
Seemed a little more comfortable, maybe, you know, in the role he was getting
he
established.
He wasn't quite into his I'm bored mode of the later ones we're going to talk about. Yeah,
that's for sure. All right. So moving on to 1964's Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm.
Directed by Guy Hamilton. I can't remember why Terrence Young didn't come back for this one, but Guy Hamilton took over. Connery was 34 in this. Now, this is kind of like probably it's one of the best, in my opinion.
This is my favorite of the ones we're talking about today.
It is, eh?
Yeah.
Okay. It's not mine, but it's...
I kind of knew which yours is going to be, yeah, but this is my favorite.
It's definitely up there. It's definitely one of the Bonds I've seen the most. It definitely stands up. It stood the test of time. Like, I can watch this now and it's still a pretty, it's a really fun
one. Well, this is the one that also, like I said, how the last one was starting to deliver what I expected from Bond going in, not being like familiar, like not seeing these movies. Goldfinger totally delivered, for the most part, everything that I was expecting from a Bond movie.
It really does.
Yeah. Like, this has got, like, you know, the pre-credit sequence where it's like there's a secret lab filled with nitro that blows up, and, you know, and he goes to bed with this dancer, and he sees the thug's reflection in her eye, and then he, like, turns her and she gets hit in the head instead of him being hit in the
head.
That's
the girl from that I mentioned from Russia with Love,
you know. And then there's all this fisticuffs, and there's this bathtub electrocution where Bond looks at him in the bathroom. He goes, "Shocking!" And I'm like, "Oh yeah." So that was like, okay.
I have exactly the same thing. Blows up refinery, tucks under wetsuit, yeah. Sex, fight. Reflection and I, girl hit on head, one-liner.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like the perfect opening credit sequence.
And, of course, I had to laugh when I saw, like, the name Pussy Galore.
Oh, yes, yes, as did everyone else.
I'm like, oh, yeah.
It's awesome.
I'm like, that's what if Bond was to write an autobiography, it'd be called Pussy Galore.
For sure. Yeah. Okay, so we've got another title sequence. Again, Maurice Binder did not do this. Robert Brown down again. A great theme song by Shirley Bassey.
Yeah, this is when people really started to notice the theme songs. And this was also when, because I remember even growing up that people were always like, ooh, I wonder who's going to do this next Bond theme song. Like, it was a big deal. I mean,
it really was. And, you know, there were, you know, we'll be going through them all. There were definitely some questionable choices. Adele. can you imagine Bond listening to Adele? No, I can't.
Bond would probably be like, see, this is when Bond's listening to Adele, is when he's at the end of his spying career. He realizes that he's no longer get Pussy Galore. He's drunk on a martini shaken, not stirred, in a bathtub, and he's slitting his fucking wrist. That's when Adele comes into play. God.
Fucking Adele, man. Oh, God. Oh, I don't know. Should I go on a tangent? No, I'm not going to go on a tangent.
Don't go on a tangent. We got a lot of movies to fit in.
Yeah, Jesus Christ, Adele. Okay, so we...
You know what my next note is? I'm just going to say my next note after I put who the title song was. I was like, the womanizer's back, and he's bedding them quick as he can, and he's pushing them down with the palm of his face on the beds and all kinds of stuff.
Yes, he is. So, yeah. So we're okay. So we're going to go through some of the locales here because that's pretty much gold figures all over the world. So we started off in Miami, where Bond is being massaged by Dink, a woman named Dink.
Nice.
And I wrote slaps her on ass. So obviously sexist, misogynist Bond is coming out.
Yeah. Is that before or after the scene where he gets knocked out? And when he wakes up, there's this girl covered in gold. He's just like, hey,
no, that's before. That's before.
Okay.
This is when we're first introduced.
All right.
Just a side note on the character of Dink. She was played by an actress named Margaret Nolan. And her naked body is the naked body that's prominently featured in the title sequence.
Oh, okay.
All those projections on her that's that actress.
All right.
So if you're ever trying to
if you're ever trying to put a picture on the, if you're ever trying to put a face on, if you're ever trying to put a face on that silhouette when you're cranking one out,
just look at Dink. Look at Dink.
You'll be looking at Dink.
All right.
I'm being as sexist as Bond. Let's bring it home.
Okay. We're also introduced to a new Felix Leiter. So Jack Lord is gone. Now we have a character named Cece Linder playing Felix Leiter. Again, not as cool as Jack Lord, I think, on purpose. And then we've got a scene where Bond's sort of watching. I think he meets up with Jill Masterson, the character of Jill Masterson, and they're watching Goldfinger cheating at cards through binoculars.
Right.
And I think Jill Masterson is kind of in with Goldfinger, right? Isn't that what happens?
He's up on isn't he in his hotel balcony?
Yeah.
And Goldfinger's by the pool.
Yeah.
Cheating at cards, and he's watching him before he goes down and makes a formal introduction to him.
Yeah, and I feel like she was feeding him. She was looking through binoculars. Yeah,
she was feeding him on the radio.
What
his cards were.
And then Bond does something so he can't get the feed anymore and loses.
Yeah.
Anyway, we introduced the character of Jill Masterson, played by Shirley Eaton. She's, again, a very, very, very famous Bond girl, mainly because, as Chris mentioned, Bond gets knocked out for one reason. It's been a while since I've seen Goldfinger, so I don't quite remember all the plot points. But she is knocked out, and he wakes up and looks over on the bed, and she's there painted in gold, supposedly killed by skin suffocation from paint, which is something that can't actually happen in real life. But it's a pretty cool scene, and I've actually seen a number of behind-the-scenes shots of her on that bed and getting painted and stuff, and I just think the whole thing's really cool that, this is how a character is killed, is that she's painted in gold, and that's how she dies. It's pretty amazing.
My skin can't breathe.
And she's, head to toe, covered in gold paint. It's a
you imagine having that job?
Yes. Yes, I can.
Fair enough.
I love her. I think she's one of my favorite Bond girls. Even though she has a very, very, very small role, she's not in this movie for very long at all. Okay. So then we move to London. We get to meet up with M and Moneypenny again.
Yep, and their interplay is great.
Yep.
And we also are introduced to the Aston Martin.
The Aston Martin DB5.
Yep.
This is a very, very famous, probably the most famous Bond car.
Yeah,
I would absolutely say.
Definitely for
There's been some other cool ones, but this is the one.
This is the one I associated with it going into.
Yeah. It's got a number of gadgets on it. I think it has an ejector seat. Don't push the red button.
Yeah.
I think it had an oil slick.
Of course it did.
Yeah.
What do you think that 80s video game Spy Hunter was based on?
Right. It had the revolving license plate.
Yeah.
I think it had machine guns in the front. It's a fucking cool car. It actually was here at the car show a couple of years ago and I went and saw it. Yeah, it was awesome. Nice. And it had a bulletproof shield. I don't think that maybe didn't show up till Thunderball, because this car made a return appearance.
I don't remember it in this one.
It's in Thunderball for sure. The same car returns. We also Bond also meets Goldfinger in person at a golf game, and he also meets Goldfinger's henchman named Oddjob.
Hell fucking yeah.
Who is, probably... Like, this movie just has so much of the, like...
This is where all the iconic stuff from the Connery era comes from.
Yeah.
And I'm watching, I'm like, okay, I know that, I know that, I know that, I know that. And this is a guy who hadn't seen any of these movies. I'm like, I know that. Yep, I know that scene.
Yeah, so even just to this point, we've got the theme song, which is quite famous.
Yeah.
We've got Oddjob and Goldfinger, who are both quite recognizable.
Well, yeah, because Oddjob's just this imposing, like, bowler-wearing, like, suit-wearing, like, big Asian dude. He's, like, this big stocky guy, and he's got this fucking razor-tipped hat where the first time he takes off his head and throws it, he fucking beheads a statue at the golf course, and you're like, oh, shit.
He is awesome.
Pretty badass.
So we've got those two guys. We've got the Aston Martin. We've got Jill Masterson painted in gold. So these are, all of these things are things that, you know, are very iconic of the whole series. So pretty great stuff. So we've got the golf game, Connery being pretty, again, Connery's really kind of, I really embraced the role at this point.
Yeah.
And this is where I feel like he's having the most fun. And really has hit his stride. So as far as I'm concerned, as far as the Connery era goes, this is by far the best and his best performance.
Yeah.
He was really into it. And
I think that's also why it worked the best for me as a movie in this first block. Like, this is why it's my favorite, because you can tell he wasn't bored yet.
No. And, you know, just, and the golf game in particular, like, just the way he was kind of playing with Goldfinger, and he was like, he did some sort of like switch of the golf balls and stuff, and he was being really cocky and funny, and just really great stuff. Okay, so now we move to Geneva, where we're introduced to another Bond girl named Tilly Masterson.
Before that, though, I just want to point out there is a sequence where he's chased in the Aston Martin, and one of the other gadgets that we didn't mention comes out, where he has these razor tipped, like, these buzzsaw things come out of the hubcaps of the car, and he rips along the side. Or maybe it's a henchman's car that rips
that
the Aston
Martin.
That
was in this sequence.
Is it in the sequence?
Because he meets up with Tilly.
Because I wrote it before I wrote Tilly's name
down.
Oh,
did you?
Yeah.
Interesting. Maybe there was a couple of scenes with the Aston.
Yeah, I don't know. But there's just the scene where the car gets ripped up with this, like,
razor
kind of like this buzzsaw
tire
thing. And I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, really cool. Okay, so he meets up with Jill Masterson's sister, Tilly, who's, like, out for revenge against Goldfinger for killing her sister. They investigate Goldfinger's enterprises at nighttime. Bond goes there, and then Tilly is there as well. And then I wrote down show off Aston Martin. So there was a chase kind of in the forest with the car, and some of the things were shown off there. So it may have been there, it may have been earlier.
Yeah, but that was where they used the smoke screen, and that's where all the henchmen guys were shooting their machine guns at him.
Yeah,
and they were like, the bullets were bouncing off. So I guess it was in this movie.
Yeah,
there was a lot of guns blazing in this sequence, I remember. And isn't this the scene where he's driving through the forest, kind of being chased and being shot at, and he, like, comes up right to the edge of a cliff and then has to back up because he almost drives off a cliff? That's in this sequence, I think.
It might have been, This is also the sequence with the ejector seat.
Right.
He does push the red button, and Tilly dies. She's killed by Oddjob, and...
any friggin' time a woman gets close to Bond, she dies.
And then the car gets destroyed.
Yeah.
So it looks like, because it does come back in the next movie. Bond's taken captive, and is the next scene is, again, kind of an iconic scene.
Definitely.
Where he's laid out on a table, tied down to a table, and again, beautiful Ken Adam production design. We've got this little table in this huge room with this giant laser that's, like, shooting down between Bond's legs, that's going to basically cut his cock off and slice him in half, and he has to have a interaction with Goldfinger.
And here's the line, Josh.
And talk his way out of it.
Do you expect me to talk? No, no Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. I'm like, yes.
Yeah. It's pretty great. That's actually, yeah, a very famous line for this movie.
Yeah. That's why I wrote it down, because I knew that line even before I'd seen the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, Bond gets out of his situation by bullshitting his way out of it.
Of course.
Yeah, and then shortly after this, we're introduced to Pussy Galore.
And Pussy Galore's Flying Circus.
Pussy Galore's Flying Circus.
I fucking howled.
Flying Circus of Babes is what I said.
I howled when I saw the name of it.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God.
Now, Pussy Galore is... could be maybe the most famous Bond girl.
Famous named Bond girl, anyway.
Yeah, definitely way up there as far as Bond girls probably go. She's played by Honor Blackman. And they, and we're kind of introduced to the plan.
The ridiculous plan. Is that where we're told?
Is this where he reveals the plan?
We're going to rob Fort Knox.
Oh, no. He reveals the plan in the next scene, which is where Goldfinger meets with a bunch of mobsters in his control room. And I wrote down Ken Adams' name again because it was another pretty epic set. The room moves, the floor opens, there's a big map in the floor and stuff like that. But the plan is that they're going to like spray nerve gas.
Yeah.
In the air and then they're gonna like take over Fort Knox and steal the gold or
something.
They're
gonna rob Fort Knox. Yeah, you know, gold.
But you know, and I'm not sure if it's revealed here or later in the film, but that's actually not really Goldfinger's plan, because what he's really wanting to do is he's wanting to taint the gold so that his gold is worth more.
I think that's later in the movie that they reveal that.
It's kind of revealed that that's what he's really trying to do. But the idea that everyone kind of is aware of is that they're going to spray this. The Pussy Galore's Flying Circus is going to spray this gas from the air and poison everyone, and then they're going to rob Fort Knox.
Every time I just hear Pussy Galore's Flying Circus, I chuckle.
Now, one of the gangsters named Mr. Solo or Mr. Soto or something. Anyway, he's kind of a loudmouth, and he meets a demise.
Here it comes.
In one of my, of course, one of my favorite things that I've talked about on the show
here
before.
Here it comes. What happens, Josh?
He gets thrown in the trunk of a car
and
taken to a junkyard.
And
the car is thrown in a motherfucking car crusher.
And what happens?
The car.
Odd Job sits watching, smiling.
He does. And it's so awesome because, you know, this guy's in the back of the car. Like, you see the car being crushed. And it's like a scene that's like lovingly shot as we're like seeing every angle of this car being smashed and compacted.
Here's my notes. Car crusher, 3 exclamation points. That's how you dispose of rivals.
You should. If I was a mobster, I would have a junkyard.
You'd have a car crusher in your backyard.
I'd be car crushing the shit out of everything. I'd be getting rid of everyone that way. Fuck the cement shoes. This is what you do. How are you ever going to get the body out of the mangled car, right?
You've been thinking about this too much.
It's fucking perfect. I think I fell in love with car crushers because of Goldfinger. Goldfinger and Christine.
All right.
Okay. So
I just want to throw out my next note after the car crusher one, where it says hand-to-hand romp in barn leads to roll in hay.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even write a note about that. I just wrote pussy changes sides.
Yeah, they have a fist fight and then they end up making out right after they beat each other up.
Which is interesting because it's kind of implied that Pussy Galore is a lesbian, but she's clearly not.
No.
Unless Bond is just so
she likes irresistible.
So Pussy changes sides. They get into Fort Knox.
They're flying over Fort Knox, and they drop the gas, and everybody instantly passes out.
They do.
The guards are just standing there in front of Fort Knox. The gas hits, and then boom.
But what really happened is they're all faking it.
Oh, yeah.
Because Pussy Galore changed the canister, so it's not the gas anymore. And all the soldiers that look like they're passing out are actually just pretending.
Ooh.
So they can jump up and fight
Goldfinger's
switch. this. So we get into Fort Knox.
They should have been like, after they passed out, they should have all ran in and be like, surprise, jackass.
Totally. There's a big fight with Bond and Oddjob in Fort Knox. Which
in
is,
the vault, yeah.
Which is pretty, it's pretty, I great, thought this pretty
was
good fight.
The, I yeah. thought this was the best fight in the series up to this point.
Really? Over Robert Shaw?
Yeah, I really, really liked this fight.
Yeah, it's a really good fight.
I actually really liked the whole finale, to be honest, and this is the first time, like the first two finales, remember I said they were weak,
yeah,
and this finale I was like, this finale is kind of exciting because, you know, they're down in the vault area and all these people are shooting machine guns from the walkways above, yeah, down at them, and they're fighting each other, and I'm like, I'm actually kind of digging this finish.
Well, plus there's some, I thought, some really effective suspense because there's also a bomb that's going to go off and Bond has to not only fight Oddjob,
yeah, because it's in like this big rolling, yeah, chest, and he has to try and like open it up and defuse it, but he's getting shot at and having to fight people, yeah, at the same time. Yeah, that was kind of cool too.
Pretty cool stuff. And anyway, Bond disarms a bomb, and then just like from Russia with Love, you know, we think it's over, but no, they go on an airplane, and then fucking Goldfinger's there, and then they, you know, get into a bit of an altercation, and yeah, then Goldfinger gets sucked out the window.
Surprise, jackass!
But yeah, Chris, you're absolutely right. I mean, this one is, you know, whereas the other movies, I felt kind of like went a bit limp.
I never felt bored during Goldfinger.
Yeah, like, you know, the other ones kind of, you know, built up and then, you know, went limp before they really kind of blew their load.
Whoa.
Sorry, I don't know why I said that, but that's
it's all the sexism in the Bond air.
Maybe, but that's kind of what happened. It just, it, you know, but this one, it really felt like it really did deliver. Like, I thought that that this big Fort Knox siege that was going to happen, I felt things really did build up to it, and I felt it really did deliver, particularly the fight with Oddjob, you know, the siege with all the shooting and guns and the bomb diffusion. There was a lot of suspense there. I thought it was a really well done scene.
Yeah, like by this, when this movie finished, I was like, there might be hope.
Yeah.
I was like, this was pretty rad. There might be hope. And then, you know, Thunderball happened.
Okay. We'll get to Thunderball in a sec. Okay. So, again, going over the cast, Honor Blackman played Pussy Galore. She was on the Avengers for a while. We're going to have a lot of Avengers references as the series goes on. Gert Frobe played Auric Goldfinger. He was maybe going to come back in another. Actually, she was going to come back in a later entry into the series, but that never materialized. Oddjob was played by a professional wrestler named Harold Sakata. I posted a pretty funny commercial he was in the 70s where he kind of reprised the role of Oddjob in like a Vicks commercial or something. Shirley Eaton played Jill Masterson. Tanya Mallett played Tilly. She never really went on to a acting career. She was a model and she went back to modeling afterwards. And we've talked about Margaret Nolan. Margaret Nolan also had, she was kind of a nude model. So there's some footage out there if you're interested in Dink. Ken Adam and Bob Simmons returned, so they were absent for From Russia with Love, and, you know, as Chris has mentioned and I mentioned, you know, the production design back in this movie is really noticeable again with everything from the Fort Knox sequence at the end to the, you know, table with the gold on it and the title sequence and everything else. Really noticed Ken Adam's production design. Oh, and of course, Goldfinger's lair where he's got the map in the room and all that. Guy Hamilton directed this. He went on to direct four titles in the Bond series, two of which are some of my favorites. So I've always had a when I think of Bond directors, Guy Hamilton's the name that pops into my head. Even though he only did four of the movies, I thought there were four really good ones. Well, three of the four were really good ones.
Yeah, I was gonna correct you for a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, the theme was sung by Shirley Bassey. And a little known fact is that future Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page played guitar on that track. So some of the gadgets in this one, we've gone through most of them. We've got Oddjob's bowler hat, of course. We've got the laser. And that's, yeah, there wasn't a lot of Bond gadgets, were there?
Not really.
He didn't have a lot of gadgets.
No, just the car did.
Yeah, the car had... I mean, there's a lot of... I've got a lot listed here, but yeah, the car is kind of the main gadget in this movie, and it's a hell of a gadget. So that's Goldfinger.
Yeah. Now comes my favorite.
What time is it? How long have we been going for?
An hour and a half.
All right, it's not bad.
All right.
Okay.
Let's get the worst out of the way.
The worst?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not gonna agree with you on that one. Okay.
For me, let's get the
definitely
worst.
Definitely a, like, you know, definitely
a fucking disappointment.
A letdown after
Goldfinger,
for sure. And had I been like a Bond fan back in the '60s, had I been alive, I think, yeah, going to see Thunderball after Goldfinger would have been like, oh, really? Okay, so Thunderball, 1965. Connery was 35 at the time. Terrence Young returned to the series because I don't know why Guy Hamilton didn't come back. This is the last time Terrence Young would direct a Bond film. Thank goodness. Sorry, Terrence. Okay.
I got to admit, though, there's some funny stuff in the opening.
In the opening?
Yeah. The pre-credit sequence where it's like, it's a funeral and you see the initials JB on the coffin.
Yeah.
And then like, there's this widow who's apparently grieving and she gets punched in the face, but it's really just a thug in disguise and they have this big fight and then Bond runs away and he takes off on a jetpack. I'm like, okay, that's okay.
And then Lance, and there's a babe with the Aston Martin.
Of course there is.
They're trying to capture the stuff from Goldfinger, but the jetpack is a pretty another pretty famous.
I just liked them punching the grieving widow in the face.
Yeah, I think that widow was supposed to be like the JB that died.
Oh, okay.
It was him.
Oh, okay.
Disguised as his own widow. Okay. Again, Thunderball. I mentioned earlier, like some of the fucking plots are convoluted. This one is the most it's really convoluted.
No shit.
I had to watch Never Say Never Again to try and understand what was fucking going on in Thunderball. But in right down to the opening sequence, like, yeah, it was pretty amusing, but I didn't really know what the fuck was going on.
No.
And like, why did he goes in this stupid, he has this jetpack that like,
it's just sitting there. He's like,
and like, it takes him like 20 feet. Like, what's the point?
Like, look at me get away.
I
faster.
Think it goes off a roof and then down to the ground pretty or much. Something. But the cool thing about the jetpack, it was an actual working military jetpack. Hmm. Like, it was an actual thing that worked. So, but I guess if jetpacks are only going to take you like across the street, they're probably not going to be common.
Like, how are you going to get away? They'd be like, oh, by the time you've flown over there, they'll be where you're fucking landing. They could just run. All right, how you doing?
All right. So we've got the jetpack pre-credit sequence. Kind of cool.
Got our typical silhouetted credits with a Tom Jones ditty.
Yeah, we got the Tom Jones singing Thunderball. Yeah.
I don't even remember how it goes, but if it's Tom Jones, I'm going to assume it's just Thunderball or something like that.
If he stops, it's Thunderball.
He's a Bond man. Hey, 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 he's a Bond man.
The only notable thing about the theme is that it's kind of, and I think it may be an urban legend, apparently Tom Jones passed out on the final note in singing this.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Because he held the note for so long.
I'm sure, just like there's a woman being murdered on the Love Roller Coaster song, right?
Well, apparently sure. On Goldfinger, Shirley Bassey also
almost passed out
singing the last note.
Okay.
So I don't know if this is just Bond urban legends or if it's reality.
Did Adele pass out when she was singing the last note too?
Don't mention her name again. We're not talking about Adele until Skyfall. Unless you want me to fucking go off, because I certainly am happy to.
No, it's okay. Let's talk about
fucking covering the fucking Cure. Fuck off.
Wow. Okay. Thunderball. Come on. Back on track.
Okay. fuck, you got me going now. Okay. Blofeld and Spectre return.
Yep.
Does Blofeld actually show up in this one?
He's in it because the...
No, it's Anthony Dawson again. Okay. We don't see his face again. He's just petting his stupid cat.
Yeah, it's just the petting the cat thing.
But sorry, we didn't mention that. We were talking about Blofeld before. He's always got a white cat with him.
Yeah.
Just like Dr. Evil. Blofeld and Spectre return. The numbered henchmen return.
Dude is burnt up in a chair.
Dude, is that at the beginning here?
Yeah.
Okay. Right, again, another Austin Powers thing where someone's like, in a chair and their chair gets torched.
Yeah, they're having like their typical Spectre meeting and guy says something that pisses him off, so he gets burnt to death in his chair.
Yeah. Now, I don't know why I wrote this down. I wrote down flowers on corpse eating grape.
That doesn't even make any goddamn sense.
Don't know why
sense.
I wrote that down. Not that the corpse was eating a grape. I think there were flowers on a corpse and someone was eating a grape. Anyway, I don't know why the fuck I wrote that down.
That's okay. My next line seems to be typical for all these Bond movies where it says, I love Moneypenny.
Okay. So there's a Moneypenny scene. Okay. Yeah.
It seems like I wrote that in every single movie's notes.
Are you attracted to Moneypenny?
No, I just like the character.
Like, you're not getting a little
boner
when you're
singing.
I like
the character. Okay. I just really like the character and how she plays off of James Bond. I really think it's fun.
Yeah. Lois Maxwell was in something quite famous and played like a... I think she played kind of a femme fatale.
Really?
I'll have to look up what that is. Like, I can't remember because I remember seeing it and being like, holy fuck, that's Moneypenny. And it just didn't fit for me because I just know where is Moneypenny. Right, right. And so the actress just didn't work in anything else. But I'll have to look up what that is. Okay, so after that part, we're brought to a health club where Bond is recuperating from injuries, I'm guessing.
Yeah, he
gets, from his jetpack. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe the jetpack. He's like, fuck, that was an incredible 20 feet. I better get on this spine stretching machine.
Well, yeah, we're introduced to a character named Pat or Patricia. Pat Fearing, then a nurse, and I just wrote, Bond forces himself on Pat.
Pretty much.
Yeah, like, I think it was kind of, like, pretty, like, gross.
Well, here's my notes, okay? So, basically, before that happened, though, we got a little bit of the tidbit of the plot early, you forgot to mention, that Spectre's plot is to steal $280 million from NATO, just so you know.
Okay.
Just so you know, because that was thrown in there just, you know, as a toss-away thing. But I wrote... Spine stretching machine, silly slash dumb. My next line says, he proceeds to hump her, and then it's pointing at silly and says, sexism. So obviously he was trying to take advantage of somebody.
It was this Pat.
Yeah.
Like, it was... Okay, so this is the first time in this series where I was actually kind of grossed out by Bond.
I was like, what the fuck's he doing?
I was like, he's getting really kind of lecherous and rapey. Like, it just didn't really... Like, I know he's a womanizer, but it felt gross. Like,
true.
And I was like, what's going on, Sean? And I think Sean, I don't know what was going on with Sean, but yeah, it was pretty lame. Okay. So then there's like Chris said, there's a kind of a rack machine.
Yeah. Spine stretcher.
And, Bond gets into a fight with a character named Count Lippe, and it's kind of a cool fight in this like health club, but I don't really have a lot to say about that. Then we're introduced to Major Duval, there's some sort of something going on with a plastic surgeon and a character named Angelo Paluzzi, who's getting plastic surgery done so he can...
It's so he can steal
a
plane.
Take over, yeah. Like, he's getting plastic surgery so he looks like the pilot of a plane.
Yeah, and then they steal the plane.
Yeah.
And then that has atomic bombs on it.
Yeah.
And they land it in the underwater lair.
Yeah. Yeah. So they landed on the ocean, and then it, like, floats down into the water. Yeah. And then we're introduced to our first fucking extended underwater sequence, which completely slows the movie down.
If you thought Thunderball was moving slow already at 2 hours and 10 minutes, just wait till those underwater sequences.
Yeah, so we've got frogmen coming out and, like, going, and
they got their little fucking handheld fucking hovercraft things, so they're like puttering along, and I'm sitting there going, fucking hurry up, Just get there already, goddammit.
Yeah. Now, I think this was probably pretty innovative at the time. Like, this underwater photography was probably quite groundbreaking, and they were really showing it off, but it was too much. Like, they were, like, lovingly showing, like, every, like, screw being screwed in the underwater layer as they were, like, or every, like, you know, piece of welding that was being done as they were trying to get into the plane. And, oh, my God, it just went on and on and on. So yeah, that was a major like grinding halt to like whatever you know, wherever we were going with that as far as acceleration went. Okay, but things do change a little bit because we're introduced to a couple of Bond girls. One is named Domino.
My next note said always a car chase before you talk about before I wrote anything. Oh, down was there about another Domino. Car chase?
Yeah. Fuck, I didn't write any notes on this one.
I said he's trying to seduce Domino, but right before that I put always a car chase.
Yeah.
So obviously there was one that I don't remember anything about.
Oh my God. This is going to be a bad review, I think. Okay.
It's a bad movie.
It's a bad movie. It's not my favorite. But it is a... Okay, I did do some looking as far as like what fan favorites are, because I always thought Thunderball was a fan favorite.
Yeah,
it's not. It's not up there with Goldfinger and From Russia with Love. I think a lot of people share our opinion on the tediousness of the plot and the length of the movie.
Good, okay.
But I always did think it was a favorite. And maybe some people still think that. I don't know. Anyway, we're introduced to the character of Domino. So this is Paluzzi's, isn't it Paluzzi's sister, right? And she's also the mistress of a villain named Largo.
I don't remember.
Adolfo Celli, the guy with the eye patch.
Okay.
So he's kind of like one of our main villains in this movie. And it's his mistress, and it's also the pilot that got killed's sister. Right?
I guess.
Oh, fuck. Okay. I got that much. Watched Never Say Never Again. You should remember this shit.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're
right. It's like the Kim Basinger character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Okay. We're also introduced to Martine Beswick returning.
I actually Never Say Never Again easier to follow.
Yeah. I agree. Okay. Martine Beswick returns. She was one of the gypsies that we talked about in From Russia with Love. She's back as another agent named Paula. She has a pretty brief scene, and she kind of helps Bond seduce Domino by I think she's like they're on a boat and she pretends that their engine's broken down or something like that. Anyway, Martine Beswick always looks good in a bikini. It was nice to see her again. If you like her, you could see her in a bunch of Hammer movies, most notably Prehistoric Women, as far as I'm concerned. Okay. We're also shown a very famous boat called the Disco Volante. Maybe it's very famous. It's quite a famous vehicle in a Bond film, but it's also a Mr. Bungle album, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. We're also introduced to a shark tank, which is kind of cool. That's at Largo's lair.
Yeah.
My
note says they throw a dude into a pool filled with shark. That's cool enough.
Yeah.
Then, you could tell I was stretching for something to like by this point.
It was pretty tough. It was a tough movie to like. There's a Mardi Gras parade.
There's a lot of people sneaking around and I'm just like bored of that too.
Yeah. The character of, Fiona, played by Luciano Paluzzi. She was the sort of femme fatale in this movie. I thought I was going to like her a lot more. Didn't really think there was much going on there. She was no Barbara Carrera, I'll tell you that. Then we pretty much get into the finale, which is a big fucking underwater fight that goes on for way too long.
So here's my last notes for the finale, okay? The first thing I wrote before the finale happened was, Young's return as a director, not that welcome. Okay.
Russia with Love was pretty good, though, right?
It was, yeah. But not that welcome of a return. I said, snoozy underwater scenes, slow-paced scuba finale with bubbles and harpoons. And I also said, it's pretty sad that my favorite moment of this entire movie was the fucking jetpack in the pre-credits.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you on that.
That's pretty sad.
Yeah.
And I think this is where Connery started to get bored.
Yeah, I mean...
He's been cranking them out. This was his fourth movie as Bond in like 4 years.
Yeah, I'm sure he was starting to get a little bored, for sure. Yeah, I mean, the underwater fight, like... I mean, I wrote down, it must be hard to do. I mean, it must be hard to stage that.
I mean, like, how exciting is an underwater fight? It's like, ooh, you're shooting a harpoon gun, but the fucking harpoon's going almost as slow as your goddamn fucking propeller thing.
Yeah, it's hard to tell who's who.
It's like, you can't have any suspense when the friggin' you could just, like, kind of just like, ooh, I'm swimming to the right, the harpoon's gonna miss me.
Yeah.
When they're coming so goddamn slow.
Exactly. And there's also, like, some sharks, but it just wasn't... You're right. It just wasn't exciting.
No.
Plus, you didn't know who was who. So I'm like, is that Bond? Like, should I be worried right now?
They're, all they're all in their wetsuits. You can't see who tell who's who.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, after the excitement of friggin' Goldfinger...
Yeah.
This is what you give me?
Yeah, and even with the villain, too. Like, I thought this Largo character was no...
Yeah, I even
no
have a
Goldfinger.
I even have a note written. Poorly defined villains.
Yeah.
I wrote that down right after I said Young's return as a director, not that welcome.
Yeah, like it's like you're supposed to be like so like you're supposed to know so much what Spectre is now. It's like it's almost like Young and the writers felt like it was a big like exciting thing for us for Spectre to return. I really couldn't fucking care less. Like all I really cared about and I didn't really have a feeling about Blofeld because we'd never seen the character, right? I didn't know who Blofeld was. I mean, yes, I guess they're trying to build like this universe and this mystique around the character, but it just wasn't really working for me. And yeah, this was, I felt, a big bore.
This, like I said at the beginning, this is my least favorite of all the movies we're talking about today.
Yeah.
And there's good reason for that. This movie is a fucking slog to get through, and there's nothing in this that is even worth grasping onto apart from fucking Moneypenny, really. Like, that's sad.
Well, okay, I'm just gonna talk about the women a bit, because okay. They were worth
well,
I thought the women
to
in
a
this
point
were really they were really nice to look at. Sorry, I don't want to sound bad.
You're sounding like Bond right now.
I did sound like Bond, but I'm not trying to sound like a dick. But I just like I did think they did kind of stand out as being, and it's because of the fact that they were. You know, we had a gorgeous French woman played by a Colleen Auger, played Domino, and then we had an Italian woman played by Luciana Paluzzi, played Fiona. And then we, of course, as I've mentioned a few times, Martine Beswick. So I did really like the Bond girls in this. Just on the cast, there's a couple of notable things for horror fans. Adolfo Sully, who played Largo, was also in Danger Diabolique, directed by Mario Bava.
I love Danger Diabolique.
Yeah. Claudine Auger, the French actress, she was in Bay of Blood, directed by Mario Bava, and she was also in Black Belly of the Tarantula, a pretty famous giallo. And Luciana Paluzzi was played by Luciana Paluzzi was in the movie The Green Slime, and also in 99 Women, directed by
Green
Jess Franco.
Slime.
Yeah, so genre fans will know these guys quite a bit. Rick Van Nutter played Felix Leiter in this one. He was a again, like, I thought he was more going back towards Jack Lord a bit. He was wearing shades quite often through this movie. Thought he was a little cooler, but I also thought he didn't really have much to do. But he was a little cooler than Cease Linder in the last movie.
There wasn't much to do in this entire film.
No. This movie also marked the first time Connery appeared in the opening credit sequence, or the... Bond walking in the what is it, like a bullet, like a gun barrel? The gun barrel. We'll
I think
call it
so,
the gun
yeah,
barrel.
Whatever it is. You know the one.
Yeah. Ken Adam is doing the production design again, which is great. But not as noticeable as in Goldfinger or Dr. No. Like, was there any production design in this that really stood out? I guess the Disco Volante was kind of cool and how it broke apart and stuff, but And I guess the lair with the shark tank was kind of cool, but nothing like Goldfinger's lair.
No, this is, like I said, this is the movie I have the least notes for, too.
Yeah.
Just because I was just so bored.
Yeah, I totally agree. The last thing I'll mention is about the crew is the fight choreography in the underground sequences. Although we didn't like them that much, they were done by Rico Browning, who was the actor who played the creature from the Black Lagoon. So that's kind of neat. As far as gadgets go, of course, we had the jetpack. Yeah, but there wasn't really a lot more going on there as far as gadgets either, right?
Not that I remember.
That was kind of the main one. Yeah.
They kind of were like, oh, we got this jetpack. Let's do it.
Yeah,
like I guess... Kind of like they did with the other movie. We got a helicopter. Let's do it.
I guess the electrocution chair was also kind of cool. But again, when we go back to like Austin Powers territory, I did find Austin Powers did lift a lot from Thunderball as well. But yeah, I think that's all the time we really wanted to devote to Thunderball. Okay. So now we'll move on to my least favorite movie of the fucking...
I liked this better than Thunderball.
Oh, I feel like I should have liked this more, but I did not. This is You Only Live Twice. So this is from 1967.
It actually took 2 years between.
Yes. Connery was 37 now. This was directed by Lewis Gilbert, who would return to the series in the 70s with The Spy Who Loved Me and one of my favorites, Moonraker. Both of which are kind of remakes of this movie in some ways.
Well, my first note on this movie is space.
Yeah.
The Bond frontier.
Yeah. Now, okay, yeah. I did not like this one. I remember seeing it as a kid, and all I remember from this movie when I was young was Japan and people jumping down on rappel ropes.
This is definitely the... most racially stereotyped and probably sexist of the movies we've talked about so far, too. Like, this is wrong-headed in its stereotyping at times.
I didn't get the sexism as much.
Yeah, but the stereotyping was really
the
bad.
The racial stuff? Oh, yeah, for sure.
It was really bad.
It was totally misguided, and I think they probably were trying to, like, celebrate Japanese culture.
I think they were, but they approached it wrong.
Oh, yeah, and we'll get to a particular part of that in a few minutes. I do remember one of the... I don't know if this is a lot... I don't know why I wrote this down, but I wrote down the words, why do Chinese girls taste different?
I have that written down, too, because that's what Bond says to an Asian girl after he kisses her.
Wow.
He's okay. Why do Chinese girls taste different from all other girls? That was not a... Connery, that was bad, whatever that was. But the opening sequence is like set in space, you know, this craft with these jaws on it comes and takes this capsule and cuts Bond's umbilical cord, so he's floating a little bit, and you know, the US blames the Russians, the UK says it's Japan.
Cuts his umbilical cord?
That's what I wrote. I said cuts his umbilical also.
Okay.
I don't know what that means. But you know, they all blame each other. Pardon me, but they also make it look like it's Bond's. They make it look like Bond's dead too, because it's like floated off into space.
Do you drink?
Yeah, I'm gonna have a drink. Keep going.
Okay. All right. So I don't really remember much about the opening sequence for this movie.
Well, it was just basically a spaceship kidnapping a capsule and Bond floating off into space. That's all it is.
So is this the one where it's like? He like fakes his death at the beginning.
Well, they think he's dead. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So the opening credits happen. We've got Nancy Sinatra singing the theme.
Yep.
Pretty good theme song, actually, I thought.
And a little trivia about the theme song is that it was sampled in the late 90s by Robbie Williams for his song Millennium.
Yeah.
Which I did not know until I started watching this movie.
I don't know the song that it was sampled in. I think I heard it in the last couple of days, but
yeah, I was like, hey, wait a minute.
It's just a din 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 din. Yeah.
That part.
I didn't know that it was a song, but
I didn't know that it was sampled from this Nancy Sinatra song until, because I've heard that Robbie Williams song plentiful times when I've been at a mall or something. So
yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess the main thing with the opening credits here is Roald Dahl.
Yeah, that's what I was like.
Roald Dahl wrote it. I'm like, what the fuck?
Now, if anyone doesn't know who Roald Dahl is, you need to go to the library. This is a famous British author. Mostly known for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which was made into a wonderful 1971 movie with Gene Wilder called Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
And he also wrote The BFG, which Steven Spielberg just made into a movie last year. He's written a lot of stuff. Danny, Champion of the World.
Did you do James and the Giant Peach?
James and the Giant Peach. If you're looking for some of his morbid, more adult-themed stuff, he has this short story collection called Skin, where the first story is basically someone beating their husband to death with a leg of lamb. He's a great creative author, and when I saw his name pop up, I'm like, oh, this might be promising.
Right.
Yeah, so I didn't know that Roald Dahl had so much racism in him.
Yeah. Okay, so we get to Japan. Bond's in Japan, whatever.
Well, you forgot that divers retrieve Bond's mummy sarcophagus-like thing first.
Oh, yeah, because it's like, it's like he was killed in the opening scene. Then they have, like, a funeral where he's, like, buried at sea, and then divers go in, like, retrieve his body because he was, like, breathing underwater or whatever.
And look at what my next note says, Josh. It says, I love Moneypenny. She's the best.
Oh, did Moneypenny show up right after the opening credits? Okay.
So,
okay, you really did. I didn't write any Moneypenny shit down anywhere. I think you have a little boner for Moneypenny.
No, I just don't. I don't get it. I just love the character.
All right.
I don't find her attractive, Josh. Stop
trying
to say that.
It's okay if you do. It's okay.
I don't, though. And then they have their timely space race plot, you know, because at the time, this was who's going to get to outer space first?
Yeah, that's right. So
they added that in.
Okay, so then we, I just wrote down sumo, so I guess they're at a sumo
wrestling. So we're in Japan.
Yeah.
They're showing the scenery. They're showing the culture. Bond taken in a sumo match in Tokyo.
Yeah.
And then there's this okay fight with the sword-wielding baddie that happens. You know, and then there's also, I wrote down, oh no, it's the trapdoor slide trick. Whichever that means. So I'm assuming someone is on a floor and a trapdoor falls out.
Yeah, I wrote mirror slide in subway tunnel.
Yeah, there's something going on with a trapdoor.
Okay, so again, Canada production design. Again, very noticeable in this, I thought. Yeah, fuck, I love Canada, man. Like, the guy just really had a signature to his work, and it was really nice in these Bond films when he was behind the scenes there. Okay, so Bond's in Tokyo. He meets up with his contact over there named, I think, Tiger Tanaka. And
how fucking stereotypical can you get? It's Tiger Tanaka.
Right. They
come up with this code phrase, I love you, which they play for laughs through the entire goddamn movie.
Right.
Yeah.
I love you?
Yeah, that was the code phrase. If you're in trouble or you need to contact us, you have to say, I love you.
Oh, okay.
You know, that thing where it's like a safe word, you know?
Right.
Like, you know, Bond's getting a rub and tug and he wants them to stop. He's like, I love you. You know? Something along those lines. I'm actually surprised with how bad this movie is for its racial stereotypes that Bond doesn't get a rub and tug at one point.
True, yeah. Okay, so in addition to Tiger Tanaka, we're also introduced to Aki, who's Tiger Tanaka's assistant.
But then, also, I wrote this down because this is totally sexist, because there is a line in this movie, because you said you weren't sure about the sexism.
Yeah.
There's a line in this movie where, I don't remember what the scene was, but it was something about a subservient woman, and Tiger says to Bond, in Japan, men come first.
Right.
So there is sexism in this movie.
Well, it may still be the case, though. I mean, it's a different culture.
But you were saying I didn't remember it, but I wrote that down. So because they're bathing him, that's what it is. They're bathing Bond.
Oh, the bathing scene. How could I forget?
Because I got an arrow saying they bathe him with an arrow pointing to that line. So that's what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess they're going to an onsen and Bond and... is it Tanaka?
I think it's Tanaka.
They're in their pools at the onsen, and then Bond's surrounded by all these like bikini clad Japanese women, which I think might be the poster actually. But maybe. Yeah, that's really sexist.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
In Japan, men come first.
Yes. Yeah. Like, there's so many things I could do with that line.
there is.
Okay, so we're also introduced. Like I said, we're introduced to Aki.
Yeah.
Played by Akiko Wakabayashi. And
you didn't butcher that too badly.
I didn't think I did.
It did pretty good.
Yeah, thanks. So she's kind of the love interest for Bond. Then they end up going to they're going to visit the company of Osaka Chemicals, run by Mr. Osaka or Osaka. And they're trying to figure out what's going on, and while I'm trying to figure out what's going on, we also meet Osaka's secretary, Helga Brandt, who's kind of the female villain in this movie, who's also really horny for Bond. The only real thing I know that he gets kind of caught at Osaka Chemicals. The notable thing about this sequence is there's a fight with Bond and this kind of like tuxedo-wearing sumo wrestler dude, big Asian dude, and they get into a fight in kind of the boardroom. Turns out that guy, because I was like, that guy looks really fucking familiar. The reason he looked familiar is because it's The Rock's grandfather.
Rocky Maivia?
His name is Peter Fenerick Maivia.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
And he looks like The Rock, and it's like, whoa, it's really funny. Whoa. So, yeah, you got to check out that scene again on YouTube or something, because it's pretty hilarious, because it's like he actually looks like The Rock.
So for plotting, I wrote that there's an okay car chase, but I said car chase okay, but magnet helicopter great. So I don't know what that
giant
means.
Giant magnet on car chase.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a helicopter that I think swoops down with this giant magnet and like picks up the car or something. I don't remember.
I assume I like that one. And then I said shipyard fight, decent enough too.
That was a decent fight. Yeah, yeah. They go to the shipyard. So it's Aki and Bond at this shipyard. I guess it's probably Osaka's shipyard, and it's... I thought that there was a pretty good fight there.
And then my next line says, I've been waiting for Pleasance, because Donald Pleasance's name is in the credits. And I'm like, it's almost an hour in. Where's Donald Pleasance?
Exactly.
And then I'm just going to go through my next note, too, because I think this ties in what you're saying. Karen Dor Helga?
Helga Brandt, yeah.
Okay, so you were just talking about her, right?
I was.
I said, she's your typical fiery redhead spy who threatens Bond with scalpel, is undressed by him, and promptly abandons him in place.
Okay, no, so what happens is Helga Brandt, she played by Karen Dor,
yeah,
is in a plane with Bond.
Oh, in plane, that's what
she's
it is.
She's going to kill him. Then she decides, nope, I'd rather fuck him.
Yeah.
So she does.
Yeah.
Then she jumps out of the plane
or something. That's what it was. Okay.
And he's left there and not knowing what to do because he's in this plane by himself. Anyway, he ends up landing the plane and whatever.
Well, my next line said, a whole load of silly mini plane scene is big proof of this.
Okay, so then we're led to a main gadget slash vehicle in the movie called Little Nelly,
right,
which is this it's kind of like a glider miniature plane thing that he goes in, and he goes and flies up, and that's where he discovers there's this like layer hidden in a volcano.
Yeah.
But he's also chased by helicopters. Like helicopters.
So that's what I must have been talking about when I said mini plane.
That's the mini plane, Little Nelly, and then there's a chopper attack.
Right. Okay.
So then he finds the base hidden in the volcano. We find out that Spectre has been hired by China to start a Soviet-American war. I'm just not sure on like the time frame here, because I know, okay, at some point Aki is poisoned and it killed. But I think no, okay, that happens later. Okay, so the next thing that happens, we find this volcano set. There's a cool monorail in there.
Yeah.
We meet a henchman named Hans. Yep. We find out that fucking Blofeld has piranhas.
Yep.
And that Helga Brandt is thrown into the piranha pit and killed in a pretty gruesome scene for a Bond movie. We're also introduced to the fact that there's a ninja training school. So there's ninjas in this movie, which yeah, I thought would be selling you.
I wrote down, right after I wrote down about the piranha pond, I wrote, top secret ninjas!
Yeah.
I'm like, Tiger has them, but they're not all dressed in black.
Awesome. Okay, so we got the ninjas. Then we've got the scene where Bond is...
Here it is, folks.
Goes undercover.
Here it is. Here's my notes for this. So, they disguise him badly as a Japanese man.
Oh.
Fake eyebrows, wig, and kimono, but still the British accent. Very, very fucking, oh my God, offensive.
It is horrible.
Wow.
Now, yes, Connery was wearing a wig in all the fucking Bond movies, but this one was something else. This is like the worst toupee I don't even know if it's a toupee. I think he's actually, because he's wearing a toupee in all the Bond films, like because he's balding in real life.
His actual hair.
He was balding in real life. But this one, it actually looks like a wig. It's terrible.
Yeah.
And the eyebrows are terrible.
Wow, and the kimono. And I'm just like, holy shit. It's
embarrassing.
I'm like, if you're trying to pass him off as a Japanese man, take away the British fucking accent or something.
You know,
you're going to go full bore on the stereotyping, just have him do the typical, oh, yeah, 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 you know, that kind of thing.
I know.
Like, seriously, you might as well fucking just do it. You've already gone the offensive route. You might as well just keep going.
It felt so racist to me.
Oh, and big time.
Honestly, when I was researching this episode, I was quite shocked at the fact that there is not an outcry about this. No one talks about this. But it's fucking horrific.
No, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, I was so embarrassed. It's like almost, well, I don't know if I'd go this far, but you know when Mickey Rooney did the whole Chinese thing? And
Breakfast at Tiffany's?
Was it Breakfast at Tiffany's? Yeah. Yeah, like just terrible. Or some of that early stuff, like in particular the Mickey Rooney thing.
Like
it wasn't that bad, but it's pretty fucking bad.
I almost feel like if they would have played that a little bit more for comedy and had him have the stereotypical voice and everything, then it would have been maybe a little bit more like, oh, we can forgive that because of the time frame and because it's done with humor. Whereas they're dead fucking serious doing this, and that makes it worse.
Yeah.
Like, wow.
Yeah, it's like, 'cause I'm something like, else.
I actually didn't mind the movie up to this point, right? And then this scene comes, I'm like, what the fuck's going on?
Yeah.
I'm just like, talk about like... being insensitive. Wow.
My God. Yeah, it's really bad. Okay, so after the racist disguise, this is when Aki is poisoned and killed. And I thought this was a pretty effective scene because it's like there's an assassin while they're sleeping and they use like string to like drip poison down.
Well, wasn't before that it was like there was a wedding ceremony between Bond and her?
No.
Or was that after?
I thought Bond got married to another character named Kissy Suzuki.
Okay, because I wrote right after the whole thing about like him disguising himself, I wrote wedding ceremony, so the cultural stuff is okay for the time, but Flick isn't overly interesting. And then my next one says suction cup climbs his way in. So I don't understand. I don't get the context of that.
I do remember a suction cup scene.
That must have been after the poisoning then.
Yeah, clearly neither of us were really engaged at this point.
Well, no, I was just so like shocked by that other thing. I was kind of checked out a little bit.
I fucking checked out on this way early. I do not like this movie at all. All I know is Aki is poisoned in a pretty cool scene involving string and poison. There's another character shows up named Kissy Suzuki, who's like the new love interest. They go to the end of Vulcan. People are rappelling everywhere. It's one of these scenes that just feels like it's just sort of thrown together. People are just fucking running around everywhere. Well,
it's like, for me, I was like, it feels like it wants to be this grand scale action sequence finale. But I was really out of it by then.
I was. Yeah, I can't agree more. And I just didn't really give a shit anymore. So I was kind of done. Now, as Chris mentioned, Donald Pleasance does finally show up in this movie as Blofeld.
Yep.
So this is the first time we actually see Blofeld. This was obviously clearly the inspiration for Dr. Evil.
Clearly.
There's no doubt about that. And
same freaking suit and everything, basically.
Yeah. And I thought Donald Pleasance did a pretty good job. Unfortunately, because I haven't seen this in a very long time, all I could think of was Dr. Evil when I was watching him.
Yeah.
Because I'm more familiar now with the Austin Powers movies than I was when I first saw this. So in a way, I think Austin Powers has kind of wrecked Donald Pleasance's version of Blofeld for me, because he wasn't menacing at all. I thought he was gonna, like, I thought Mini-Me was gonna come running out, but he didn't. So that's about it for the plot. Yeah. And we've kind of already said what we thought of the movie. Yep. I mean, I despise this movie.
I liked it more than Thunderball, because I did like some of the earlier sequences, but around the time when they get so racially insensitive, I checked out.
Yeah.
And I was done. So yeah, I can't recommend this as one you rush out and watch for sure.
The interesting thing about this one, like, as far as like when I talk about how much I don't like the movie, is that as far as the Moore movies go, like, they are ridiculous. Like, the Moore ones get really ridiculous. And as far as, like, ridiculousness goes, this is probably the most ridiculous of the Bond movies of the Connery era. So I almost feel like I should have loved this. But maybe it's the fact that it's set in Japan and it just doesn't work. And I don't know what it is, but something about it just really rubs me the wrong way, and I just don't like it at all.
I actually feel like one of the ones we're going to talk about in a few is more ridiculous than this, to be honest. But yeah, this is definitely not up there for me. I liked bits and pieces of it early on, but then it just, like I said, I checked out.
Yeah. Yeah. Couple of notes. Well, actually, I don't really have a lot of notes on the cast. One is Bond's main contact in Japan near the beginning of the movie, Mr. Henderson, is played by Charles Gray, and Charles Gray would actually return in Diamonds Are Forever as Blofeld. I thought that was a cool bit of trivia. The two main Japanese actresses, so again, Akiko Wakabayashi and Mi Hama, who played Aki and Kissy Suzuki respectively, they were both, got cast mainly due to the suggestion of Toho Studios. Toho Studios was quite involved in this production in that they provided a lot of the production facilities and sound stages. They also provided a few of these actresses, and they also provided some of the crew.
Movie might have been more interesting if Toho provided the Godzilla suit.
Exactly. one thing I did think was pretty weird about those two women, though, is that I'm not sure which was which, but one of those characters was actually not let go from the movie because she wasn't able to speak English very well. So she actually threatened to kill herself. So they cast her again. They gave her a part. I think that may have been Mi Hama, but I'm not 100% sure on that. But I thought that was a weird bit of trivia. Roald Dahl, actually, I mean, the script, I thought it was a little more ridiculous than other Bond movies. He took over from Richard Maybaum, who has done, he's written so many of the Bond movies. I'm not sure what happened here and why Roald Dahl was brought in, but I didn't really feel like it was a good fit. There was a lot of problems with the script. Yeah. And the other thing I just want to mention is, as far as Chris has sort of alluded to this a few times, but fucking Connery was done.
No, you could tell.
He was over it.
He checked out about as much as I checked out.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting because Connery did come back in Diamonds Are Forever, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes. But he actually seemed more done in Diamonds Are Forever. But in this movie, like, he was just fed up with the character. I mean, he was fed up with being Bond. He was fed up with being associated with Bond. I think he was being, like, really accosted in Japan when he was there, like, as a celebrity. And but you could just really tell, like, the enthusiasm was gone. He just wanted to get through this thing. So,
and that's what leads to our next film, where he did get out of this thing.
He sure did. And then a breath of fresh air came in.
Well, compared to the last movie, yes.
Yeah. So the next movie in the series is On Her Majesty's Secret Service from 1969, directed by Peter Hunt. Peter Hunt edited the first five Bond movies. Or is there five now? Four. Five, yeah.
This would be the sixth one.
Yeah, so Peter Hunt was the editor on all the other Bond movies. Well, he wasn't really the editor on You Only Live Twice. He came in and sort of saved the movie after the editor that was brought in kind of fucked it all up. So George Lazenby...
Maybe Peter Hunt should have edited out that entire dress-up scene.
So this is actually the last time Peter Hunt also worked on a Bond movie, but he was able to direct. And I thought he did a fantastic job. So they brought in George Lazenby to take over for Sean Connery. Lazenby was a 29-year-old model from Australia. I thought he was fucking awesome. I love George Lazenby. He's actually, of all the movies we're talking about today, this is far and away my favorite of them.
Yeah, that's just what I figured.
Yeah. Okay, so there's the opening scene, the pre-credit sequence, is a fight on a beach.
Well, it's fast cars.
Yeah.
A windy road.
Yeah.
Cool cigarette puffing.
Yeah.
Before they end up on the beach.
Yeah.
Before the manly exploits of Bond running down the beach to try and save a girl from drowning herself in the ocean.
Yes.
Don't forget that stuff.
No, I didn't.
There's a brawl.
Then there's a pretty good brawl, actually.
Yeah, I like how in the brawl, they kept on, like, they'd be showing the fights, and then they'd be, like, foreshadowing on this anchor that was sitting in the sand all the time, and then eventually someone picked it up, and you're like, I knew that was coming. You kept showing me that goddamn anchor. Yeah. I'd be waiting.
Yeah.
So there was that, and then, you know, it's pretty cool. I like how at the end, after he'd beaten everybody up, and then the girl had run up the hill and taken off on him again after he tried to save her, he looks at the camera, he's like, this never happened to the other fella.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, they know what they're doing. They're kind of self-effacing a little bit here.
Which is good, because I think just like Dr. No, I think they were very quickly trying to establish where the series was going, and I thought they did a really good job in the first 5 minutes. So and I immediately like Lazenby. I mean, people are kind of down on Lazenby over the years, you know. Especially people who don't know the Bond franchise that well, he's kind of almost like a joke, but I think he's freaking awesome. I really wish he had gone on. I thought he was a fantastic, great Bond, and really carried the movie.
I honestly found him to be a tiny bit wooden.
Did you?
I did a little bit, but I was fine with him in the role.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't think he fucked it up or anything, but I did find him to be a little bit more on the wooden side.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, this is a guy who really hadn't acted before.
Well, exactly.
And I think had he gone on to more Bond movies, I think he would have been great. I mean, this is a guy that was offered a 7-picture deal and walked away.
Right.
Like, he's stupid. but I think had he fulfilled that 7-picture deal...
Would there have been 25 Bond movies if he would have kept going, though?
I think he would have been great.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say. You always have these things where you hear about, like, original castings or things that have happened, you're always like, I wonder what would have happened if that would have occurred. And then you're like, but then you kind of like, I kind of like where it's sitting now. So maybe we'll just leave it at that. Like, you know, the whole thing with like Eric Stoltz being in Back to the Future and all this stuff. You're like, I wonder what would happen if that really happened. And I don't know how Lazenby would have done, because you're, it's like you said, I don't know if he would have had the longer lasting appeal for seven Bond movies.
Yeah.
Like I thought he was fine in this just a little bit, because you could tell he wasn't really an experienced actor. That was my main thing with him.
Yeah.
But I mean, I wasn't like, oh, fuck him, where's Connery?
Yeah.
Because by this point, I was like, Connery doesn't fucking care what he's doing anyway, so let's get some fresh blood in there.
Yeah.
So
I thought he was cockier than Connery, actually, and I kind of liked that. I liked the humor. And I liked the fact that he was a little younger. I think I enjoyed that as well. Just an interesting piece of trivia on the casting is that they were actually looking at bringing Roger Moore on at this point and doing Man with the Golden Gun. But I think there was something going on politically in the region, in Vietnam or Thailand or whatever. And so Roger Moore couldn't do it and went on to be in the television series The Saint. So that's when they brought Lazenby on. But so this all could have gone totally different. I didn't know that Moore was being considered so early. Anyway, the title sequence, there's no song over it. I did like this one because it kind of recaps the prior Bond villains and the Bond girls. I thought that was pretty cool. I also liked how the fight scenes were directed. Now, this is directed by Peter Hunt, who kind of gave us the whole like close-ups and fast cuts and undercranked camera stuff from in the prior films to his editing. But I thought he carried that same style on through here. Interesting note is that the editor and the second unit director on this film, John Glenn, went on to direct For Your Eyes Only and For License to Kill later on. There wasn't a lot that happened. So the main plot that goes on here is the woman that Bond saved from drowning herself in the ocean was Countessa Tracy de Vincenzo. And she is the daughter of a crime lord named Mark Anstraco. And he's the head of a crime syndicate. And he goes to Bond and says, look, my daughter's kind of bummed out and depressed. Can you hang out with her?
Yeah.
And try and make her happy. And Bond's like, well, no. And then Bond's like, actually, if you tell me where Blofeld is, then I'll hang out with her.
Right.
So that's what happens. Tracy soon finds out about this and confronts Bond about it, and then he kind of discovers he has feelings for her. So there's a love story going on here as the plot's meandering along and we're trying to figure out what's going on.
Tracy's played by Diana Rigg.
Yeah.
She has a really nice cleavage shot early in the movie, I have to admit.
A nice cleavage shot?
Yeah. She has a nice cleavage shot. I hate to say it, but it's true. Now I'm
what,
being...
What shot?
It's early on in the movie. She's wearing like some low-cut dress or something.
All right.
Bond gets ambushed by a thug. There's fisticuffs. And then after he meets up with her dad, he tells Bond that his daughter needs a man to dominate her.
Right.
I'm like, whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I don't know how to take that. But then it's like kind of the way the character is, because he's like kind of a crime lord and, you know, he's kind of wants just someone to be firm with the daughter because she's kind of a free spirit and wild and everything, yeah. Right? But, you know, and then you're like, say, there's that love story in there, which leads to a montage, which has this sappy song playing in the background.
It's a great song.
I'm just like, it's kind of sappy, dude.
So the song, the sappy song is... is Louis Armstrong doing We Have All the Time in the World.
But it's kind of sappy.
Sadly, the last thing Louis Armstrong ever recorded.
Sorry, Louis.
I don't know. It's pretty famous, man. And
I just found it to be a little bit sappy for a Bond movie.
It does set up a lot of meaning for later in the film.
Yeah. It does, but it's still sappy for a Bond movie.
to have a romantic montage in the middle. I do agree with that.
So there's all this talking about the plot, and then eventually we start globetrotting because he's going to get Blofeld, right?
He's going to get Blofeld,
We end up in Switzerland.
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, I mean, it's cliched in the way that, like, everybody, like, it's Switzerland, so they play to the stereotypes of you know, that area where it's, like, all blonde, permed people and, like, you know, all, like, all the music's playing is, like, totally stereotypical and all that, and they're up on the ski mountain and all that. It just plays to what you'd expect Americans or British people think what Switzerland is, I felt.
It's like, the typical Swiss ski village type vibe. So we're brought to this location, which is just fantastic. It's called Pies Gloria. It's in the Swiss Alps. It's still there. It's a restaurant you can go to that you have to get to by a cable car. And fuck, I want to go to this place someday in my life. I'm going to go check this place out because this is fantastic. Like, it looks like a Bond villain compound on top of a freaking mountain. And you can go there now. And it's so cool. And a lot of time is spent there. So Bond goes there undercover as a character named Hillary Bray, who kind of seems a little like maybe homosexual, but we learn quickly that he's not. I wrote here slight stiffness. Yeah. I agree. Like, Lazenby was not an awesome actor, but I feel like he would have hit a stride in a couple of movies, and I thought he was pretty fucking good in this. So he's there, and now my big issue with this is he starts seducing. There's all these women from different, they're more like races or countries, but like there's a British woman, there's a American woman, there's an Indian woman, there's a black woman, there's a Chinese or a Japanese woman, and they're all there, and he's kind of, there's no other real men there other than Blofeld and his henchmen, and Hillary Bray is trying to pretend he's like a scientist. Meanwhile, he's seducing the different women and going to their bedrooms at night, which I thought was a little off because he's supposed to be in love with Diana Rigg's character. Right. So I never quite understood that, because this whole movie is supposed to be a love story between Bond and Tracy, and to see him starting.
Perhaps that was just because they were like, Bond up to this point's been kind of a womanizer. We can't have Bond tied down with one woman. We need to have him like try and seduce some other women so people will know this is a Bond movie.
True, but it just didn't fit with the tone. No, like you just have this Louis Armstrong
montage.
You go
from a montage, to him like
banging all these women in the in the compound. So I didn't like that part. So two of the, you know, he hooks up with this woman named Ruby, who's got, you know, really short hair, is really cute. He has two girls in one night at one point. But the whole point of this whole exercise up on the mountain is for Bond to figure out that these women are being hypnotized to by Blofeld so they could deliver bacteria,
a virus, basically.
Virus, to different areas around the world. Okay, so
by the way, we forgot to mention that Blofeld in this one's played by Telly Savalas.
Yeah, he is.
And, you know, Telly Savalas is pretty awesome.
He really is. So, yeah, and I think he's the best Blofeld.
Yeah, he's better than Donald Pleasance because he's also a presence more in this movie than in any other movie. Blofeld's not really been a presence in any of the movies.
Yeah.
And I felt Telly Savalas was actually more of a presence in this one, where he actually had more screen time than all the other ones combined by this point.
Yeah, he had a lot of screen time, and he actually felt like Pleasance looked a little threatening because he had some, you know, this fucked up face and stuff. But Telly Savalas was actually seemed kind of imposing. Like when there were chases, like he was right there chasing Bond and stuff.
Right.
Okay. So let's get to some of the action because, you know, it does kind of meander along in this mountaintop place with Bond banging and all the women. But then we get to this scene where Bond is his cover's blown and he's put into this cable car room because there's a cable car that goes up the mountain. He has a buddy that's killed, and he needs to figure out how to get out of this. So he ends up, like, in a pretty suspenseful scene. He's like climbing on the cable car wires, like trying to get out of this room, which I thought was pretty effective. And then we get one of the first of two major ski sequences in this movie.
I know, and here's me, okay? Here's me. I'm a big fan of skiing movies. They're up in the Swiss Alps. I'm watching this movie, and here's what my note says. Come on, skiing action! Come on! Yeah. So I'm waiting for the skiing to start, because I'm like, you better not fucking go
I
up
told
on
you
this.
About the skiing, too,
I'm just like, you better not go up here, and there better be some goddamn skiing that goes on. But it'd be, at this point, it'd just be him, like, trying to, like, in this villa with all these girls who kept getting hypnotized. I'm like, come on, man. He's got to do some skiing soon.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it delivered.
It really delivers. Yeah. It's a freaking awesome ski sequence as he's trying to get away from Blofeld and his cronies.
And he's such a pimp skiing down the hill on one ski for majority.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was
yeah.
like, look at him go.
Yeah, and then he uses another ski to, like, smash people.
Oh, that was great, where he, like, goes into the trees. And they're looking for him, and he's like kind of hit. He's just kind of hunched over with the other ski, and the guy comes by, and he just hops up, and he just fucking whacks him, and he goes flying off the side of the mountain. I'm like, oh yeah,
yeah, it's a great scene.
That is a great scene.
So then he ends up getting down to the bottom of the mountain, and he's like being chased by all of Blofeld and his cronies. I'm also going to mention that there's one of the cronies is a character named Irma Hunt, who's going to be quite. Important later in the plot, but she kind of reminded me a lot of Rosa Krebs from what was it, Thunderball? Or maybe from Russia with Love. The other short haired lesbian looking henchwoman.
They all kind of blend together.
He's trying to get away from them, and then he bumps into Tracy. Now I don't know why Tracy happened to be in the middle of the Swiss Alps. But it's a great scene where she kind of saves him from this situation, and they jump in her car, and then they get into a car chase through the icy mountains and end up getting into the middle of a stock car rally.
Yep.
Which another pretty cool chase sequence. And then they hole up in this barn overnight. And again, now we get back to the love story. And actually, Bond proposes her marriage to her and said he's kind of done with his ways in his life. So we're really amping up the relationship with Bond and Tracy, while we also have a lot of really cool action. We then get another awesome ski sequence.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't even remember how this one started.
I don't either, but I know how it ends. Because I wrote it down.
Okay, are we talking about the snowblower?
We're talking about...
He had a lot of guts.
He had a lot of guts. That's exactly what I wrote down.
So it's this is another great ski chase. But yeah, at one point, someone actually goes into a snowblower a la Fargo. And it's pretty gory, actually. And
the snow went crimson.
Yeah. And then we're also treated to a freaking avalanche where they're like trying to outski an avalanche, get buried in it, and a pretty great sequence. Finally, Tracy is taken hostage, taken back up to the top at Pea's Gloria. Bond and the Secret Service go in to rescue her. Blofeld tries to get away on a bobsled. Bond catches him, Bond chases him, and he flies up into a tree. And then Bond ends up getting married, and at the very, very end of this movie,
wow.
Yeah. What?
Wow.
The end of the movie?
Wow.
Yeah, so it's major spoiler alert, so please turn it off for the next 50 or 25 seconds. Tracy ends up getting killed, and it's
absolutely fucking
devastating.
What a bummer.
I was actually talking to my mom about this the other day, and she said she remembered the first time I watched this with my friend when I was quite young. She said she remembers coming down, and we were both just, like, sobbing.
It still hits me. What a fucking bummer.
It still hits me. How was it, like, not knowing and, like, seeing this for the first time? Like, did it shock you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I was so used to these, like, kind of tidy, bland kind of finishes, right? And then it's just like she gets fucking killed. I'm like, whoa. Because I'm like, that's something new.
Yeah.
Because I was so used to just the action sequences being over and Bond like kind of lounging in the sun with a hot chick or something. And
yeah.
And this one, he's like, he's been like basically falling for this chick the whole movie. And then she's dead. I'm like, fuck. This is like an ending to rival The Last American Virgin.
Well, it is, because it's like Irma Hunt and Blofeld drive by in this car after Bond and Tracy have pulled over and gun down the car, and then typical like 70s fashion, this, even though this isn't a 70s movie, it just ends like it's just like boom, done.
Yeah,
and you're just like devastated, right? Yeah, it's quite something. It still bums me out when I see it.
I think it's the most audacious thing that happened in any of the movies we talk about tonight. Yeah. And I think that's my favorite scene in any of these movies, just because of the balls it took for them to do it.
Yeah, I mean, we do get some stuff like this later, way later in the series, more in like the Craig era.
I'm talking about the eight we're talking about today.
Yeah, and even, well, you don't get anything like this in the Moore movies and stuff. And the other thing, you know, the other thing about this is that Diana Rigg probably is arguably my favorite Bond girl. There's some couple others that I really like, but absolutely in these movies, no question, my favorite. Like, she's, because she's spunky, she's smart, she's got balls, you know, she's gorgeous. Like, I love everything about her in this movie, so that really added to the depressingness of this whole thing. So yeah, that's the main plot. And so you were, I thought you'd maybe be more jazzed on this movie, and I'm kind of surprised you're not. I know it's long.
That's
so
main problem with it, is that it's 2 hours and 20 some minutes long, and I felt they spent too much time of just Bond creeping around on the villa with the girls.
Yeah.
And I thought that whole plot, the whole scheme of Blofeld was ridiculous to begin with, and I just thought they didn't do, like, I just thought it was pretty bland and silly for the main villain to be doing something like that. And it just was, I just didn't like the scenes of him just creeping, of them all just sitting around in the villa. It would just drag the pacing down. And I mean, I thought the movie totally picked up once the skiing began, right? But I just felt like they could have shorn another, they could have easily cut like half an hour out of this movie, tightened it up a bit, and it would have been like probably my favorite one.
Yeah, and especially with such an awesome Bond girl, like, you know, because she disappears for half an hour.
Yeah.
And which was really unfortunate too. I totally agree. Like, the whole purpose of that whole scene was so we could figure out what Blofeld's plot was.
Right.
And they could have said that in a one line, right? Like, we didn't need to see all that. Now, I think they were really trying to up Lazenby's charm and really sell him. And I think a lot of that was like a kind of like a spotlight on Lazenby.
Well, and I think it also was what I was saying. They were kind of, I think they were probably worried that, like, we can't have Bond just like kind of hooking up with one girl. That's not what Bond's about. So yeah, we have to throw in this sequence, this scene where he has to, like, you know, bet everybody, just so everyone's like, oh, that's the Bond I know.
Yeah.
You know, and I felt it wasn't necessary, and it did drag the movie down for me quite a bit.
Yeah.
So half an hour, and it'd probably be right below Goldfinger.
Yeah. And for me, this is, I love this movie. I was a little leery about the running time when we kind of were looking at it. But this to me is absolutely top five in the entire Bond series. No question. I'm not sure where in the top five it's going to end up, but it is absolutely in my top five. So cast, Lazenby, so like I said, he was offered a 7-picture deal, didn't want to be typecast. So he actually, before this movie was even released, he said he wasn't going to come back. His agent also told him that, wouldn't be a good idea. So he was able to get out of that. I mean, major, major, major mistake. I think he should have done at least one more. If he had done one more, the whole end sequence, the depressing ending, was actually going to be the pre-title sequence of Diamonds Are Forever, but they changed all that when they discovered Lazenby wasn't coming back. He did go on to make some notable movies. He had quite a career. He did some stuff in Italy, and he did some stuff in Hong Kong and Japan. But notably, he did a giallo called Hussar Die, which is pretty good. He was in The Man from Hong Kong, the Brian Trenchard-Smith movie that recently came out on Blu-ray.
That's a great flick.
Yeah, and he was also in Never Too Young to Die, which has also come out recently on Blu-ray.
Well, Never Too Young to Die, he's totally playing a spoof of his Bond character, though.
Yeah.
Because he's John Stamos's dad in it, and he's like a super spy.
Yeah.
So it's totally a parody of...
Yeah, and a lot of the stuff he did was a parody on Bond. Yeah. So, there was also talk of him coming back in Never Say Never Again when they were casting that. And until Connery said he wanted to do it, it was looking like it was going to be Lazenby, which I thought would have been a pretty cool choice. But I think it's too late for now for Lazenby to come back as Bond. Diana Rigg, as I said, one of my favorite Bond girls, if not my favorite Bond girl. People will know her most as playing Emma Peel in The Avengers. And what a fucking babe. And, like, I love her. She's also recently in as a much older version of herself, being in Game of Thrones. I don't have a lot more to say about the cast. Angela Scholar, who played Ruby, the short-haired girl on Peace Gloria, she was in Casino Royale. She also met a tragic end where she drank Drano and doused herself in it and burned herself to death.
Holy fuck.
Horrible, yeah.
Why you gotta bring me down?
Catherine Schell, who played Nancy, the other girl Bond beds up there, was in Space 1999. And Joanna Lumley, who was up there, but we didn't really notice her. She was, of course, in Absolutely Fabulous, and she was in the new Avengers as one of the stars. So, again, a whole bunch of Avengers connections here. Lazenby and Rigg did not get along at all. There's a very famous quote where she shouted across the room that she had just eaten garlic right before one of their love scenes. And I'm not sure the extent of how much they didn't like each other, but I don't think she has fond memories of him. It sounded like Lazenby got a real ego in this movie and probably made it a little difficult. But I think he also had a really hard time as well because people weren't taking him seriously. In particular, director Peter Hunt sounds like he really didn't like Lazenby and made his life a little bit shitty. As far as casting goes, I already mentioned the Moore thing. Another interesting piece of casting possibility was that Timothy Dalton was also offered the role of Bond in this movie at the age of 22. And of course, Dalton would take over after Roger Moore did, in the mid-80s. The Aston Martin showed up again in this movie, but it was a different model. Didn't show up for very long, though. And I just wanted to give a shout out to Willie Bogar. He was the ski cameraman, and I've seen footage of the making of this movie and the shit this guy was doing, like skiing backwards with like a camera between his legs and like crazy shit. Like this to capture those ski sequences was really something else. He also did the ski sequences in Spy Who Loved Me, and when we get to that one, you'll appreciate that. Yeah.
He also directed a couple of movies that are not great movies, but great for skiing action. He made one called Fire and Ice in 87. Yeah. And then in 1990, I think it was 1990 or 91, he made a movie called Fire, Ice, and Dynamite, which co-starred Roger Moore.
Oh, so are those action movies?
Yeah, they're action movies. There's a lot of skiing and explosions going on in them.
Oh,
They're not great movies, but if you're into skiing like I am in movies for some reason, they're pretty fun.
Yeah.
They're pretty fun just for those action sequences alone.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, so that's On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Okay. Now let's get to my second least favorite.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Okay, so I actually have seen this movie quite a bit. So we're talking about Diamonds Are Forever from 1971. Guy Hamilton returned to the director's chair and after Goldfinger. So Guy Hamilton directed Goldfinger. So I had high hopes. Connery was 41 at the time. Wow. I mean, as when I was young, I know this one and Goldfinger and Dr. No were the three Connery ones I watched a few times. And I really stuff from this movie really stood out in my brain. But man, this was tough.
Well, let me tell you though, I think this is my favorite pre-credit sequence of the series so far though.
Okay.
In this movie, because it's got, you know, it's a pretty great opening with Connery's Bond just being this total badass trying to find Blofeld's location. So he's like,
because he's pissed.
Because he's pissed off because, you know, his woman died, I guess, because they're kind of carrying on that. But he's like, you know, he goes to a casino and he says, hit me, and beat someone up. You know, he goes up to this girl who's in a fucking like hot tub or a pool and he fucking chokes her out with her fucking bikini straps.
Yeah.
Like, where is he? Where is he? You know, and he's, you know, tossing scalpels at people and shit. And then fucking he finds Blofeld, knocks him into this fucking pit of mud, which he's basically drowning in. And he says, he's like, welcome to hell, Blofeld. I'm like, holy fuck, this is awesome.
Yeah.
I'm like, I hope this whole movie keeps this up. Fortunately, doesn't happen.
Yeah. And it's funny because the sequences in this movie that really popped for me, like as far as memories of childhood, still are awesome. Like you said, this was a pretty great opening sequence.
Oh, it's fucking great.
Yeah. Okay, so after the opening sequence, and again, Ken Adams back again doing production design in the opening sequence. We can see that again because it's pretty great. We're then introduced to Mr. Wint.
Shirley Bassey does the song.
Oh, yeah. Shirley Bassey returns from Goldfinger to doing Diamonds Are Forever, which is a very famous, probably one of the more famous Bond
pretty
songs.
Pretty hit song.
All of them are pretty famous, right? I mean,
pretty much.
But yes, it's a good one. Then we're introduced to Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd. So there are a couple of henchmen.
I kind of like these guys, admittedly.
They're really great, and they're really memorable. Like, these guys also, I totally, in particular, the opening sequence with them where they're, like, confronting this diamond kind of smuggler dude.
Yeah.
And they kill him with a scorpion, and that was pretty cool. Mr. Wint is played by Bruce Glover, who's Crispin Glover's father. He's been in a bunch of stuff. I mainly remember him from the Walking Tall movies. But he's pretty creepy, as is Mr. Kidd, who's played by a jazz musician named Putter Smith. But they really play off each other well, and these are also openly homosexual characters, which I thought was an interesting choice given the time period.
Yeah, I liked both of these characters. I thought they added a little bit of decent comic relief to the movie, but at the same time, they were like just nutty enough that you were like, ooh.
Yeah, they were pretty threatening when they when they showed up, you knew someone was going to die.
Yeah, right? Basically.
So, they're pretty threatening. We have another new Felix Leiter. This is the one played by Norman Burton. This is my least favorite depiction of Felix Leiter, I think, ever. Because he's kind of like a bumbling, like, donut cop type character. Didn't like him at all. So the main story on this one is Bond goes to Amsterdam disguised as a smuggler, a diamond smuggler named Peter Franks. He meets up with a woman named Tiffany Case, played by Jill St. John.
Whose first appearance is very scantily clad, I must add.
Yeah, now, we'll get into that in a sec. but also, I will say one thing about that. First of all, I did think, oh, she's pretty sassy. She's pretty sexy. She might be a really great Bond girl. But I'll just cut to the chase right now with that. She ends up just being more like eye candy.
Pretty much.
I just felt like she had no backbone, really no personality. And too bad, because I thought she could have been a really good
one. I also like to mention that before they go off to Amsterdam, I was kind of on board for the most part just because the high camp levels were pretty evident early in this movie. Because there's like, you know, there's a scene where the miners would sneak out the diamonds in their teeth.
Yeah.
And the dentist would, like, take them out and pay them off.
and there was like, you know, the scorpion in the shirt, and there's an exploding helicopter and stuff like that. I'm like, okay, if this movie can keep this up, this might be my favorite.
Yeah.
And again, like I said, with the opening sequence and all this stuff, promises.
No, seriously, the opening sequence, Winton Kid and all that, and the campiness, I totally agree. But then, I don't know what happened, but they go
it
to...
It just loses its... It loses that feeling to it.
It's interesting, though, because when I'm looking at my notes, like, a lot of the stuff was pretty fun. Like, they go to Amsterdam. He meets Stephanie Case. He kills the real Peter Fanks in an elevator fight in, like, one of those steel elevators.
Right.
I thought that was a pretty good fight sequence. Then they hide the diamonds or something in Franks's body, who Bond has convinced Tiffany Case that he's Peter Franks and he just killed James Bond.
Yeah, it gets a little confusing.
It does
here.
Get a little confusing. And then they somehow get the diamonds into the body and ship the body back to America.
Yeah, so he ends up going to Vegas.
Goes to Vegas and the...
Goes to the funeral
goes
home.
Goes to the body to a funeral home.
Yeah.
Where it's there, the diamonds are being passed on to a new smuggler named Shady Tree. So there's a pretty cool, like, cremation sequence. And then Wint and Mr. Wint and Mr. Kid show up and try and kill Bond, put him in the coffin.
I thought that sequence
coffin.
Sucked.
I thought it was okay.
I didn't like it. I thought there was absolutely, positively no payoff to that scene.
Well, it did feel like, I felt like...
Because it's like, they put him in a coffin.
Yeah.
He can't get out. They put him in the fire. You see the fire creeping all around him. You're like, ooh, they have a good chance for some suspense here or something. And all of a sudden, the lid's thrown open and he's perfectly fucking fine.
Yeah, I didn't understand why he was even saved, right?
Yeah, like, I didn't like that scene.
Yeah. I liked, you're right, I liked the setup of that scene, but I didn't like how it ended.
Yeah, the payoff sucked.
Yeah. Okay, so they're at the funeral home. There's a new smuggler, Shady Tree, Bond and the Wind thing. Then it's revealed that Bond actually had put fake diamonds in the body. So Shady Tree's all pissed off and wants the real diamonds. So then they go to the White House Hotel, which is like this hotel owned by this Howard Hughes-type character. Bizarrely played by country singer Jimmy Dean. And I'm not sure really what's going on because they get to the hotel, Shady Tree's there now doing stand-up comedy, and then he's killed by Winton Kid. And I didn't really get what was going on there. All I know is that Lana Wood shows up looking super hot as a character named...
In a super low-cut dress.
Yeah, playing a character named Plenty O'Toole, who is again, we're talking about Bond girls. She's one of those ones that pops up right away. Which, again, very, very small part. She's...
But she's not good in it, though.
She's not good.
She's a bad actress in this.
Yes, but she's got giant boobs.
Yeah.
And, it's basically...
Literally, my notes are like this. Plenty, Lana Wood shows up. Yummy, low-cut dress. Circus is cool. Elephant wins slots. Because there's a scene of an elephant winning a slot machine. Then I'm like, Wood is bad. Good thing she's killed off.
Right.
Like, she's not good in it. Like,
she's basically seduces, Bond kind of seduces her.
Yeah, like, he kind of
does. They play craps together, then they end up going up to his room. Yeah. He's going to fuck her, but there's some henchmen there who throw her out the window, and she lands in the swimming pool. Then he fucks Jill St. John.
Yeah. Then he goes down in the morning, and Plenty's floating dead in the pool.
No, he goes to Jill St. John's house.
Oh, her house.
And she's in
her
pool.
Oh, okay, that's what it was.
And then Jill St. John's like, oh, you're James Bond. Oh, I'm going to stick with you rather than trying to double cross you because my life's in danger.
Yeah, here we go with the convoluted plotting again.
Oh, my God. Then somehow this character named Bert Saxby shows up and he's got the diamonds and goes to this research building.
Oh, fuck.
Which Bond goes and infiltrates and tries to go undercover as like a scientist.
Fuck. This
and
whole sequence can go to hell.
I didn't really know what was going on. And then next thing you know, the alarms start going off, and Bond escapes on a moon buggy.
Yeah, he's booking it through the fucking desert in a rover-like vehicle. And I'm just like, fuck.
Yeah, it's really stupid. And I don't really know.
And it was like,
what the point?
It was a really bad car chase. Like, I'm just like, what the hell? Why? Okay, so he's taken this identity. He's bust into this lab. Then all of a sudden, he's running away in this moon buggy. I'm like, this is just dumb. This has nothing to really do with anything.
Yeah.
And thankfully, it's followed by a fairly decent chase scene through the downtown of Las Vegas. I actually kind of liked that one.
Right, because I don't remember what the transition is, but
yeah, either do I. Really.
He somehow is on the run from the cops now, and it's a pretty good chase. It's not one of the best chases in a Bond film.
Compared to the moon fucking buggy one, it's pretty good.
It's pretty good, and it's really cool seeing Vegas, you know, in the 70s, kind of, and it's all taking place on like Fremont Street, so it's all the neon and signs and everything.
Yeah.
And there's a pretty cool stunt where the car goes up on two wheels through an alley. And,
yeah, like through a really narrow alleyway. But you see, my problem is, it's got these sequences in it, but at the same time, the plot doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense.
No, it's really hard to follow.
Again, like the earlier Bond movies, not like the last movie where Telly Savalas was like chewing it up, this has very badly defined villains.
Yeah.
Like, apart from the two henchmen guys we talked about, I don't fucking know who the bad guys are in this movie particularly, because they're so badly defined. Like, you're just like, oh, do I care?
Well, even Blofeld, because what happens now is we think Blofeld's dead throughout. Then we, after this car chase, he somehow...
Oh, God, this fucking
Bond
thing.
Bond ends up in the hotel, the White House Hotel, and somehow discovers two Blofelds.
Yeah,
because one of whom's like a double.
Because there's a fucking subplot about Blofeld cloning himself.
Yeah, like I didn't, and that's what the whole it explained kind of what was going on in the opening sequence, but not really, like because that's what was happening. It was Blofeld was creating a clone, and that's who Blond killed in the opening sequence, right? I think.
Yeah, but it's just so stupid.
It's so stupid. So then after he fights Blofeld, Tiffany gets kidnapped by Winton Kidd. Bond goes off to try and find the Willard White, who's holed up in some house out in the desert.
Yep.
So he goes there, and then he comes across these two women.
And they have a fucking fight.
Yeah, named Bambi and Thumper, and they're both like gymnast assassins or something.
They have a fight in a pool where... where he's beating the shit out of them. He's basically fucking holding their heads under the water and drowning them. His fucking cohorts show up. Like, I guess people from his... I guess they're from...
Felix Leiter.
Yeah, he shows up and is like, guess who's giving breaststroke lessons? I'm just like, fuck off. Seriously? Yeah,
it was really... And this should have been a great scene.
It should have been.
And I do remember Bambi and Thumper. What?
It was just lazy.
It was totally lazy. Like... because they weren't very threatening, and they could have been. Because it's like, it's almost like as soon as they get in the pool, they're all kind of laughing together almost.
Yes. Oh, let me drown you now.
Yeah, it's weird. It's a really weird scene.
So, but however, seeing Blofeld in drag not long after, that's quite a sight.
Is he in drag?
Yeah, there's a scene where he's in the back of a taxi in drag.
I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's like pretending to be a woman to get away. And he's fucking in drag, and he gets in the back of the taxi in drag. I'm like, well, that's something.
Maybe I blocked that, or maybe I was so tired.
We also find out at the time that he's using diamonds to make a powerful laser.
Right.
Mm.
And then
he's going to have a satellite lined with diamonds.
Yeah.
So, you know, the clones wasn't enough for Blofeld. He has to make a laser studded with diamonds, too.
Yeah. Then we get to his big lair, which is on a oil rig or something. Yeah. And then, this is when Tiffany Case is super dumbed down. She's just like this woman in a bikini. Then it gets into this ridiculous thing where they're trying to like switch audio tapes in this like machine. Like fucking Blofeld wouldn't, like this guy's a mastermind criminal. Like he didn't make a copy of the freaking codes or whatever he's doing. And then the oil rig blows up. The Tiffany and Bond end up on a cruise ship. They get in a thing with, they get in a fight with Wint and Kid. They die. It's over. Yay.
This is like in the finale. I'm just like, oh, look at all these bad explosions. They look pretty shitty. Oh, look, helicopters. And then I'm like, fuck, I hope Roger Moore shows up soon. I'm like, I'm done. Because this one, it had, the plot was just all over the place.
Yeah.
And it was totally uninteresting. Like, it's like you said, there's one or two sequences in this movie that I really like. But everything surrounding it kind of is like, ugh.
Yeah.
Like, this is by far the worst since, like, of, like, this is bottom tier of the Connery stuff.
And it's funny how we've got, like, rose-colored glasses, because when I was describing the Connery movies to you, I remember I kept saying, one thing I kept saying was, everything changes at Goldfinger, which is true.
Yeah.
It does change.
But then you also told me this would be, like, one of my favorites.
And I honestly believed that. And then I was watching it, I'm like, what the fuck was I thinking? I mean, I love Vegas, so maybe it's because it was set in Vegas, but holy shit. And it was just, and Connery was just so checked out, right? Like,
I don't even know why he came back, to be honest.
But there are things like, you know, I mean, Wint and Kid are quite memorable.
The opening sequence, man.
Plenty O'Toole is quite memorable. The oil rig stuff, even though it sucked, the location's quite memorable. So
I just like had so much hope going in when that opening sequence was so badass.
Yeah.
Because I had never seen Bond being such a like badass. Like, you know, you don't see Bond fucking just going up to people and just beating the shit out of them to get information, right?
Yeah.
You don't see him choking girls out with bikini tops just to get information. I'm like, oh man, he's back and he's pissed and this is going to be great. And
yeah,
unfortunately it didn't pay off.
No, it didn't. Okay, so as usual, some of the cast we're going to go over here. Okay, so Saxby, so the guy that Bond trails to the moon fucking buggy place, he's played by Bruce Cabot.
Fuck that whole moon buggy sequence.
But Bruce Cabot was one of my childhood favorites. So he played Jack Driscoll in the original King Kong. And always loved him. He was kind of like one of the first kind of heroes I had when I was young. And because I just loved King Kong so much. And I loved Jack Driscoll. So this was his final screen appearance. He didn't have a lot to do in this movie, but it was pretty cool to see him again. Thumper and Bambi. Bambi, the white woman, didn't really do much else. Trina Parks played Thumper. She's been in some stuff, most notably Dark Town Strutters and The Mothers. She was one of the leads in The Mothers.
Okay,
Ciro Santiago.
Not a great flick.
Yeah. A couple of what's his name's goons. Who was that? Shady Tree. A couple of his goons were played by Mark Lawrence, who was quite a famous gangster character actor that you'd recognize. The other one was played by Sid Haig, who I noticed, and I was like, what the fuck, that looks like Sid Haig. And sure enough, it was. The White House was the Las Vegas Hilton. As Chris mentioned earlier, Shirley Bassey came back to do the Goldfinger song. We also had a very, very small appearance by Valerie Perrine in her screen debut as one of Shady Acres' women. The one thing I did want to talk about in this movie is just the bizarro relationships with Lana Wood, Jill St. John, because Lana Wood was, of course, Natalie Wood's sister. Natalie Wood was married to Robert Wagner. Robert Wagner ended up later marrying Jill St. John, and he's still married to her in real life.
I'm trying to figure it out.
So Lana Wood's Natalie Wood's sister, Natalie Wood, died on that boat with Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken. And then Robert Wagner in real life married Lana Wood's co-star Jill St. John. And Robert Wagner was also one of the stars of the Austin Powers movies, making things even weirder. I also thought it was interesting how Lana Wood These are just weird coincidences, but it's how Lana Wood drowned in the movie. I thought that was an interesting parallel. And also the fact that Sean Connery in real life was banging both of them on the set, creating this lifetime rivalry between Lana Wood and Jill St. John. So it looks like Sean Connery was actually trying to live the life of Bond at this point, but wouldn't have been a bad set to be on. I guess when shit went down, though, it wouldn't have been so fun.
All I got to say about Diamonds Are Forever is that motherfucking elephant won at slots.
It did. He's about the only one that won.
Yeah, he did. He won big. The okay. audience, not so much.
Yeah, and podcast audience, you're sure winning with the length of this episode.
Hey, we just hit 3 hours.
Woo!
Let's do it. One more to go.
All right. Never say never again. 1983. So this is an unofficial entry. This is not an Eon production. This is directed by Irvin Kershner, who, of course, directed The Empire Strikes Back, among
RoboCop
other things.
And RoboCop 2.
And RoboCop 2.
Which we've talked about in our RoboCop episode, which is not 3 hours long, so go listen to it.
Yes.
After this.
Hey, Bond fans will probably appreciate this.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Right. Of course they will. I'd listen to this. Connery was 53 at the time of this movie. Just to put things into perspective, though, when Roger Moore took over the role of Bond, he was 46. So when Octopussy came out, which is the same year as Never Say Never Again, Roger Moore was 56. So 3 years older than Connery. So a lot was said, and even the way that this movie is set up is that Bond is old. I just thought that was kind of funny because when I was young, I thought, why are they bringing this old guy into the Bond movie? Why is Sean Connery coming back? He's so fucking old. Yeah. Meanwhile, Moore is 3 years older. There's no traditional Bond opening in this movie because they couldn't. The opening sequence, though, where the credits are playing over under the terrible, terrible, terrible opening song. Who was that
never
by?
Never say never again.
It's by Lanny Hall, and it's like this shitty 80s disco crap.
Pretty bearable.
Awful.
Terrible.
But it's a pretty cool opening where Bond's like running around this like compound, like trying to, it's kind of similar to the opening of From Russia with Love, actually, because it's actually a training exercise. But
yeah,
I thought it was pretty good. And just, yeah, on a side note here, Never Say Never Again is a remake of Thunderball. So, yay.
Better than Thunderball.
Okay. So we're pretty quickly introduced to Barbara Carrera. Now, I've talked about Barbara Carrera a few times on the show. Love her, and she's as sexy as ever. Well, definitely as sexy as Eye the Jury and Lone Wolf McQuaid. She's playing the character of Fatima Blush, who's based on Fiona Volpe from Thunderball. So she's like the femme fatale. Just like Thunderball, we go to the health farm. There's the fight in the weight room with the big guy. This time he has like this weird knife weapon that seems to be able to cut everything up. The big guy is actually played by Pat Roach. You may know him as the German from Raiders of the Lost Ark that gets chopped up in the propeller. There's some nukes involved here, which are part of the plot. With some very, very bad early 80s visual effects. Man, I don't know how anyone thought this shit looked good back in the day.
Well,
okay.
It's a little rough.
My next note says fucking Rowan Atkinson playing the Q-type character.
Yeah, he's like the British Embassy contact.
Oh,
and I'm just
my
like,
God.
When he showed up, I didn't recognize who it was at first. I'm like, oh, fuck, Mr. Bean.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, thank you.
No, and so did not belong.
He's played so heavily for comedy in this.
It's awful.
Yeah, it's not that great.
It's awful. It's awful. Oh, my God, I hated it so much.
Okay, but before he shows up, though, I would just like to say that Max von Sydow plays Blofeld. Forgot to
Again,
mention that.
Again, very limited role, though.
But he's in it, at least.
Yeah.
I like the scene where early in the movie where after he gets to the health camp there, the nurse is like, I need you to fill this beaker. And he's like, from here?
Oh, yeah.
Where she's standing on the other side of the room. And she So that was pretty funny.
It says Spectre addicts a dude to heroin and replaces I with exact copy of the U.S. president.
Right.
There's that scene.
So this is the whole like from the, it's like the whole plastic surgery thing from Thunderball. Yeah.
I said Carrera is pretty sexy as Spectre badass, especially when she's posing as a nurse.
Oh yes, she was. I loved it. Yeah.
And I said
that was like super boner material because she had a nurse's outfit and then these like knee-high boots that were that was ridiculous.
And then I said pretty good brawl through kitchen with Hitman. So I guess there's a fight scene through the kitchen at the health spa.
And the weight room. That's the guy from Raiders of the Lost Ark. That fight was pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
That guy's awesome. That guy should have been in way more Bond movies. But he's always good as a heavy.
And then before Rowan Atkinson shows up, Kim Basinger shows up. And her first appearance is in tights and leg warmers, busting a move. And it's awful.
Yeah, it really is. She's doing like ballet or something.
Yeah.
But she's you can see her nipples like constantly. She is like a total sex object of this movie.
Totally.
Like every time she's on screen.
There's no other purpose for her to be here.
And there's some scenes where she's wearing like sheer tights. Like you can actually see her nipples and stuff. It's pretty ridiculous. Okay, so then we get Barbara Carrera like trying to seduce Bond. She's doing she's on a boat, and then she's on water skis in this like bathing suit that's like kind of like a thong and looking pretty hot. Then I wrote down shark attack. I don't know.
Yeah, they rig Bond with sonar so that he's chased by a shark.
Yeah.
So I was like, what the fuck? And that scene was pretty funny because it's like him swimming through this wreckage of this boat and the shark's chasing him, busting through everything, and he comes out the top of the window in one of the boats and the shark comes roar through him. Yeah. Like, oh, okay, this is kind of stupid fun. And after that, he basically massage molests Basinger while she smiles.
Oh, yeah, he totally does.
It's pretty creepy.
Yeah.
It's pretty creepy, especially because she's like, in this movie, she's probably in her, like, what, 23, 24?
Yeah.
And he's like 53 and he's like fucking massage molesting her. It's kind of hard to watch.
Well, especially because he's like, it's like the way he goes in front of her to massage her. Yeah. So her like hand that's up is like rubbing against his cock. And it's really gross.
It's pretty gross.
Not even because he's older. It's just like lecherous.
And then there's this pretty elaborate but overlong video game sequence that he has.
Okay, so he goes into this room.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, he goes through this room that's filled with people playing Centipede. Like, yeah, there's just tons of, like, there's an old game from the 80s placement called Centipede. But it just didn't even make any sense. Yeah. Like, everyone's playing Centipede.
Well, fucking Centipede, man.
Centipede's pretty fun.
If it was Ms.
All
Pac-Man,
the kids are going to, like, all the younger people listening to our show are going to look it up and be like, what the fuck, guys?
If it was Ms. Pac-Man, I could see why people would be excited. But Centipede? Come on.
Didn't make any sense. Okay, then
they should have been playing Q-Bert, because at least he curses when he dies.
It's true. Okay, then he has to play against okay, we had Eyepatch Largo and Thunderball. This time we have another Largo played by Klaus Maria Brandauer, and he's pretty suave, actually. I actually kind of liked him as a villain. But he has to play this stupid fucking video game against Bond called Domination.
And it's terrible.
It is so bad. And I don't understand.
I didn't even get how the game worked.
No, I don't understand how the game worked.
Because it's basically like, here, hold these triggers, and I'm gonna shoot missiles at you, and you have to defend and shoot the missiles down. And they're playing the game, and all of this is a sequence of flashing lights. And when the missile gets through, the person gets shocked.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, watching it, I'm like, I have no idea what's happening right now.
No, no.
It was pretty stupid.
It was really stupid. Yeah. So I don't know what that was ripping off in Thunderball, but anyway, it was stupid.
It was just a cash-in on, like, war games that came out that year or something. Who knows?
Yeah. Then I wrote down Motorcycle Chase.
Yeah, I thought it was okay. It was the one where he, like, goes into that. He goes on a motorcycle through the docks and everything, and he ends up in those, like, caves and gets trapped in there. And then Barbara Carrera uses that fucking, like, a skiff thing to knock him off the motorbike.
Okay.
And then beats him up.
Right.
It's a pretty cool scene.
All right. Then I wrote down Carrera pirate outfit.
Yep.
Which
Yep.
Something else.
Yep.
And then Carrera.
She gets blown up by a motherfucking rocket pen. Bond pulls out a pen, a regular ballpoint pen, that shoots a motherfucking rocket at her and sets her ablaze. It's pretty cool. It's so silly that it's cool.
I was shocked, but as soon as it happened, I remember. I'm like, oh yeah, that happened, but I didn't remember until it happened, and it was like, oh my gosh. Yeah, she actually explodes.
But that's cool. The thing that I'm like, this is why I like this better than Thunderball. It's just so damn goofy that I couldn't help but enjoy it. I'm just like, this is just too goofy. I can't hate on this too much. I really can't. Like, Barbara Carrera just went up like a fucking Roman candle from a goddamn fountain pen. I'm like, that's pretty ridiculous.
No, that the Carrera, everything with Carrera, as usual, was great in this movie. I loved her as the femme fatale. I loved her outfits, and I loved her attitude, and I loved the way she went out.
No, she was definitely the best thing in this.
No question. Yeah. Okay, then we have Rocket Machines. No use, I wrote. I don't know why. Laser Watch. So Bassinger, she gets captured,
yeah.
And then she's being like, it's like she's being raffled off to these like Arab guys. And Bond's like tied up in this, or shackled up in this like castle room. So then he like uses his laser watch to like burn through the like shackles so he can escape to save her. And goes down and saves her. And they jump off the wall of the castle with the horse.
On a horse. And that sequence, I'm like, they're running through the friggin' village on this horse. Basinger's on the back. They fucking jump off the side of a castle wall. And all you see is the horse just fucking slamming hardcore into the water. You're like, holy shit, I hope they used the dummy.
Yeah. Because
it looked pretty brutal. I don't know if they did. It looked pretty brutal.
It really did. Yeah, and then they go back onto the Disco Volante, I believe, and then... Oh, no. I don't know. Something happens and fucking Blofeld's underwater, like, chasing Bond,
yeah.
And Bassinger ended up killing him.
Yeah, so my notes, basically, after they jump horseback from Fortress Walls, that Basinger's not very good. What the fuck are those contraptions they fly in on? Because they looked fucking ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was like, it looked like something a 12-year-old would make for science fair.
Yeah, it's these weird contraptions. And it's also, we should mention,
Bernie Casey
plays, yeah, Felix Leiter in this.
Oh, yeah.
So it's Bond, older Sean Connery, and Bernie Casey in these like weird...
Yeah, they look like something a kid would like put together in his like garage. It looks like basically you took like the frame of like an old stroller and strapped on some propane bottles or something, and you fucking jet propelled yourself on this.
Obviously they were riffing on the Thunderball jetpack.
I guess, but it was just, wow. It just was.
Yeah, it wasn't cooler. It wasn't as cool as a Thunderball jetpack. Let's put it that way.
And the Thunderball jetpack was not cool.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
And then I just said, again, too long, as they try to cram in way too much.
And you didn't mention the final shot.
Don't remember it. What is it?
It's just like fucking Franco Nero at the end of like Enter the Ninja.
The wink?
The wink at the camera. Oh. Yeah, by Sean Connery. I don't know.
All right. Fair enough.
I don't know. I don't have a lot of notes on this one. The fight choreographer was Steven Seagal, who ended up breaking Sean Connery's wrist. I wrote down Bassinger's outfits because, Jesus Christ, like every time she was on screen, she was wearing like the skimpiest shit. It was either see-through or you could see her ass or whatever. And then at the end, she's wearing this ridiculous like tiger or lion print bathing suit. Just so ridiculous. Rico Browning from Creature from the Black Lagoon again did the underwater stuff. And that's all I got. But all right.
That's it.
Not my favorite.
But that's it. We done. So let us quickly run down top to bottom our favorite to least favorite.
Favorite to least favorite. Okay.
So would you like me to go first?
Sure.
Okay, so my favorite to least favorite would go Goldfinger. Surprisingly, Never Say Never Again is my second favorite.
Wow.
From Russia with Love.
Whoa!
On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Dr. No. You Only Live Twice. Diamonds Are Forever. And Thunderball.
Interesting, because I thought we were actually quite on the same page through most of the show, but now I'm like, nope.
Go ahead.
Clearly we're not. Okay, so for me, it would be On Her Majesty's Secret Service for sure. Goldfinger would be next. I'd say probably From Russia with Love would be next, followed by Dr. No, followed by Diamonds Are Forever, followed by Thunderball, and then You're Only Loved Twice.
That's not too far off.
Did I get everything there? Yeah.
You missed Never Say Never Again, didn't you?
Oh, Never Say Never Again. Where would that fit in? That would probably fit in between From Russia with Love and Dr. No.
Okay.
No, it would go after Dr. No.
Okay.
Dr. No and Diamonds Are Forever.
So not that far off. I think it's just On Her Majesty's Secret Service, you got a lot more out of than I did.
Yeah.
But I think we're pretty close otherwise.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I mean, I think my main takeaway from all this is that the older Bond films do not stand the test of time. Like, they definitely do not come out the same way I remember them. Either Goldfinger does, absolutely, and On Her Majesty's Secret Service does. But the other ones, I don't know if I'd rewatch a lot of them.
I would not rewatch any of these again, I don't think, to be honest with you.
Even Goldfinger?
Yeah, I don't think so.
I'd watch Goldfinger again for sure. And I definitely will watch those movies again. But some of these other ones, definitely, I don't know. I don't know if I ever watch Thunderball again.
No fucking way.
Yeah.
Thunderball was, rough. Yeah,
too long.
Rough. Anyhow, so that's the first Bond episode in the can, and only 3 hours and 20 minutes.
Well, I mean, it is Bond. It's, you know, I think people that are into Bond would probably be curious about it. I think we dropped some pretty good trivia in this. Mm-hmm. I thought we had some good perspectives on it. I'm looking forward to doing the other ones. So,
I'm hoping more is a step up.
It is, man. Don't worry. Don't worry. I mean, wait. I mean, okay. So, I mean, I think if you appreciate the tone of Never Say Never Again,
I did.
You know, you do dig obviously. That, because they are more goofy than
I kind of like that.
Yeah. So I think you will like them.
We just need some more Moneypenny up in that, apparently.
Moneypenny's all over the more ones. Don't worry.
All right. Good. Good. I miss you, girl. Come back to me.
Money, Penny, Q, and M are all right, there.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. Well, that's the first episode.
But there's no Spectre, really.
Cool. No Spectre, really?
Yeah, what? Spectre kind of vanishes for a while.
So the Craig ones. I guess I'll find out.
I think pretty much. Like, Spectre's kind of like not really a thing. Huh.
I guess I will find out, and you guys will find out.
They're there here and there, but yeah.
All right.
But we'll get to it. We'll get to it.
Fair enough. So why don't you guys let us know what your favorite Connery Bond movie is by going to our Facebook page. You just search for GBW Podcast. While you're at it, follow us on Twitter. Same thing, GBW Podcast. And you can also find us at gbwpodcast.com. As per usual, we're going to ask that if you like the show, you like what we're doing, just take a couple minutes. Go to iTunes, Stitcher, whatever it is you use to listen to us, and just give us a rating and a review, because it
well can better only help. Yet because people seem incapable of doing that. honestly, like, why don't you just go to our Facebook page and maybe
start a conversation?
Make some conversation. Yeah, I personally, Chris, I know you're really into the iTunes thing, but I would appreciate that more.
No, I'd much rather
interact with people.
I would than love get the interactions yeah. too.
Yeah, because the rating thing, it feels like people can't do that for some reason. So,
Well,
interact with us on Facebook. That also does help us.
Yeah.
And it would be great to hear from people and be able to talk about stuff.
So if you want to go to Facebook and say that I'm a moron for liking Never Say Never Again, second best, feel free. I'll answer you. I'm not afraid.
Yeah, actually, it didn't really occur to me that that's what just happened until you just said it out loud. You are a moron.
All right. On that note, until next time, I'm Chris. That's Josh.